And it's good morning to Brian Johnston.
Good morning to you, Coz. Good morning, Boyle.
Good morning, Brian.
Good morning, Bearded Wonder. And good morning, everybody. It is a fine day. It's clouded over a little bit, but I'm told that it won't rain today.
And Earl Spencer having a little bit difficulty getting out of this rather rockety glass coach. I must admit, it's very well sprung. I hope they aren't too seasick after travelling in it. Earl Spencer there in his grey morning suit, and he's being just helped now as he is going up the step. And here comes the bride. What a marvellous moment for her. And as she goes up the steps, there'll be a fanfare by the state trumpeters of the Household Cavalry. The flag is up, and we're waiting for it to come down, and then it'll be the start of the 120th breakfast, and they're off. And it's Cambridge from this side here, just perhaps getting off to a bit of start. They look much neater perhaps than Oxford. Oxford are a very heavy, much heavier crew. And with you the time and their striking rate off the first minute, at the moment we're whizzing along on the right flank here, on the Middlesex side. They look really level at the moment.
But the word fun isn't on the card.
The word fun isn't on the card. Give me another word for fun.
Well, enjoyment or joy or...
You've had 18.
Oh, yeah. I've had a great deal of fun today. I've enjoyed it. I've had a marvellous time.
So how are you? How do you feel?
I feel fine.
Two balls to go this over from Morris. Four runs to get. No, is it? Is it the Ashes? Yes, England have won the Ashes.
Right, Richard, now we want a piece of music. I don't know what your taste is in that direction. Right, Richard, now we want a piece of music from you. What's your taste in that direction?
Can I have... Can I have... Can I have Golden Years or anything by David...
Lawrence. Always entertaining. Bad for 35. 35 minutes. Hit a four over the wicketkeepers. Angus, for goodness sake, stop it. Which group of stores was well known for having billiard balls above their shops?
I think that should read billiard...
pawnbrokers.
Or billiard halls.
Billiard halls.
Hello, I'm Barry Johnston. After my father died, the Prime Minister John Major spoke for millions of cricket lovers and radio listeners around the world when he said Brian Johnston was a giant among commentators. He was a man who enjoyed life hugely and shared that enjoyment with millions. Summers will not be the same again. Brian hadn't intended to join the BBC at all, but wanted to work in the theatre. After the war, he was looking for a job, when he bumped into BBC reporters Winfred Vaughan Thomas and Stuart McPherson, whom he'd met while in the army. Stuart put him in touch with the BBC's outside broadcast department, and as a test, Brown was sent to Piccadilly Circus to write a report on what he saw there. On his way back, he passed a shop with a booth where he could record a five-minute message. So he went in, told some jokes, and left this back at the BBC.
Well, he went home the other day from the office, and he kissed his wife good night, and he went up to see his little boy, who'd gone to bed early, little boy Tommy, aged 4 and a half. And he crept into the room, and there was little Tommy kneeling by the side of the bed. My friend George said, "Ah, this is splendid praying. I'll show him an example." So he knelt down on the other side of the bed. Little Tommy looked up from where he was kneeling and said, "What are you doing there, Daddy?" And George, rather pompously, said, "Just the same as you, my son." So little Tommy looked up and said, "You won't half catch it from Ma when she comes up. We've only got one under the bed, and I'm using it this side." Well, his mother-in-law came to stay the other day, and he didn't like her very much. He had an awful row with her, and he got so angry one day he picked her up and chucked her out of the window. Well, the police arrested him, and he went before a magistrate, and the magistrate was very nice to him, and he said, "Well, look here, I won't put you in prison this time, but you really must not throw your mother-in-law out of the window again. You never know who may be passing underneath." Well, he was walking along the street the other day, and there was a man and a horse and cart going along. The horse wouldn't go at all. The chap was beating the horse, and he couldn't get it to go. An old woman came up and tapped the man on the arm and said, "Stop beating that horse, that's very cruel. I'll show you how to get him to go. Get out." So the man got out of the cart, and the old woman walked around the other side of the horse, and suddenly it disappeared down the street at about 50 miles an hour. The old man scratched his head. He said, "Well, how'd you get the horse to go like that?" And the old woman said, "It's quite easy. I just tickled his tummy." The old man said, right, now you've got to tickle mine. I've got to catch the bloody thing. But I'm finishing on that.
He got the job and joined the BBC on the 13th of January, 1946. To his delight, one of his first tasks was to present radio programmes from theatres and music halls around the country, as he recalled some years later.
My first job was to run Works Wonders, a live amateur variety show broadcast at lunchtime from factories. Considering it was live with amateurs, we surprisingly never had any real calamity. We used to employ young unknown comics to warm up the audience beforehand, and two of these were called Benny Hill and Bob Monkhouse. Every Tuesday we broadcast three acts from the stage of a music hall during an actual performance. This was rather difficult because in those days the humour appreciated by a music hall audience and the BBC was slightly different. So we had to cut and select the comics material without spoiling their act for the audience in the theatre. To show you how difficult it was, I was once given a terrific rocket for allowing this gag to go through. First comic. Have you seen the PT mistress? Second comic, yes, she's in the gymnasium, stripped for gym. Third comic, lucky Jim. Compare that with what goes out today. It was a great thrill for me to go behind the scenes and meet all the artists whom previously I had admired from out front. And they were all very kind to me and tolerant of my inexperience. I met quite a few present-day stars on their way up. In a Jack Payne show at the Kingston Empire, there were Max Bygraves and Frankie Howard. And a young impressionist called Peter Sellers impersonated me and did street interviews in Entire Tonight to play an April Fool joke on John Ellison. And in a cafe after rehearsals at the Brighton Hippodrome, a comic told me he'd just been offered his very first series by the BBC and didn't know whether to accept. With his violin, he was one of the best of all stand-up comics and told stories like this.
My local vicar comes to see me now and then. Last time he came, he told me that on his way to my place, he was walking across the common when he saw a crowd of young kids, about 9 years old, standing around a puppy. They were all talking earnestly, so the vicar said, "Well, my boys, what little prank are we up to today?" One of them said, "Well, we're having a competition, you see. The one who tells the biggest lie gets the puppy." The vicar said, "Disgraceful. When I was your age, I wouldn't have dreamt of telling a lie." One of the boys picked up the puppy and gave it to the vicar. He said, "Yeah, you've won."
Yes, the one and only Ted Ray. One of my great favourites was Leslie Hutchinson, Hutch, who was mad on cricket and came and played the piano at our house near Lord's. He was once broadcasting for us from the stage of the Palace Theatre, Reading, and was singing into a microphone suspended from an arm on a stand by the piano. To my horror in the wings, I saw the mic slowly swinging away from him so that Hutch was leaning further and further to his right to try to sing into it. The audience roared with laughter, so did Hutch, and a BBC engineer had to rush onto the stage to adjust the mic. Then, of course, there were the pantomimes, and in one of Tommy Trinder's at the Palladium, I took my microphone with me and became the hind legs of the donkey. Gosh, it was hot. But perhaps best of all were the musicals, which we used to broadcast live from the stage about once a month. Annie Get Your Gun, Carousel, Brigadoon, South Pacific. I just couldn't believe my luck. Here I was, seeing all the shows, meeting all the stars, and getting paid for it.
As well as his theatre work, Brown began covering many other events. In 1946, Bertram Mills Circus put up the big top at Olympia in London for the first time since before the war.
And this is Backstage with a Vengeance. At the moment, I'm standing by the next act, which is the dog act, Louise and her dogs, and I'm actually shaking hands with one of the little dogs, the little terrier. All around me, there's, it's orderly chaos. We've got white horses just coming off now in a carriage, and all around me, there are clowns in any number of hats. They've got so many hats, I think even Mr. Churchill might be jealous. I'm standing in the gangway looking out onto the arena. I see the floodlights down on it, and I can just see the top of the big top. In fact, I'm standing under notice which says it is strictly forbidden for any person to stand in this gangway. And now there's some horses just going by me, and the black and white horses of the last act. And in front of me there are two little white ponies. They're preparing to go on in a few minutes. Now, just before they go on, we'll see if we can get Louise to come and say a few words before she goes on with her dogs. But I think, no, she's too late. They're going off now, the dogs. And so, standing by me, I have an immaculate figure in a top hat and carnation, and he's carrying a stick. And his name is Mr. Cyril Mills. And Cyril, would you like to say good evening to the listeners?
Good Good evening, everybody.
And I guess you're glad to be back to Olympia again.
Oh, it's absolutely wonderful. This is the day we've waited for 8 years. It really has come at last. And, well, I think I'm enjoying it more than most of the audience.
A couple of years later, Brown joined the programme which was to make him a household name. In Town Tonight.
This is the BBC Home Service.
I started Let's Go Somewhere in 1948, and at that time, In Town Tonight was the big programme on the BBC. Saturday night, peak time, 20 million listeners. Yes, 20 million listening to radio, and anybody of any sort of importance who came to London must be in Town Tonight.
Once again, we stop the mighty roar of London's traffic, and from the great crowds, we bring to you some of the interesting people who have come by land, sea, and air to be in town tonight.
And they all came, all the sort of Danny Kays and the Bob Hopes and the Bennies, and they all appeared. And it was a strange programme in a way, because it was completely scripted. Every single good evening, Mrs. Center, and these people used to come in and rehearse the script with John Ellison, who was the presenter. And Peter Duncan, the producer, realised he was getting a bit stultified, and he came and saw Lobby, who was my boss in outside broadcast, to say, is there any way we can get a little bit of life into the programme? And I think Lobby thought, or almost, there was a time in the 30s when John Snagg did a thing called Let's Go Somewhere, where he did odd stunts and things. And he said, well, we'll try and revive that. And this is really how Let's Go Somewhere was born.
At about this time every year, the post office asks the general public to cooperate with them by posting early for Christmas. So for Let's Go Somewhere tonight, Brian Johnston's gone down to Oxford to see how the people there are helping to carry out this request. Well now, in order to get a grandstand view, so to speak, without being seen, he's hidden himself in a place in which I don't suppose any of you have ever been in your life. So let's go and join him now as he sits in this rather tight spot.
Okay, well, when I tell you that I'm extremely cramped and that I'm sitting in a space about 2 feet square and 4'9" high, that my voice sounds rather hollow and that every now and again something keeps on hitting me on the head, will you believe me when I assure you I'm in a pillar box, a letter box? And I've got a bale of letters at my feet here. I can see the ones, I won't give the names away, but the letters here addressed to Glasgow, Dublin, London. All the addresses very clearly written, which is one of the things the post office... Oh, that one got me on the head. A package addressed to... Where's that going to? It's going to Reading.
The general idea was really to make people laugh, to get them excited and thrilled, and to do things which a lot of them might want to do, like being lifted out of the sea by a helicopter or rescued off the top of a building by a fireman, and that sort of thing. And what one's got to emphasise, that I was given, it was 3.5 minutes to four, maximum four, usually 3.5, and it was live. There's no way could I say, we'll do that again. They came to me and I did it. So every Saturday night was the first night, and obviously sometimes we made them... bit of a boob, sometimes it wasn't very good, sometimes other times it was, but it had that essential thing of being live, and the chap sitting at home in his armchair, I can say, he's actually doing that now.
Good evening. Well, I'm speaking from an alleyway just off the Strand. I expect the majority of you listening have at some time or other walked along a street and passed a man singing on the edge of the pavement. So I'm going to go out and be one of these singers in a minute and just see what it's like, and also try and find out, if I can, how much money, if any, I can get in a couple of minutes. I don't expect much. And, by the way, I'm dressed in an old Macintosh, a terrible old pair of flannel trousers and a ghastly hat, and I've dirtied my face and I've got my hair all over it to try and disguise myself. I've got a microphone hidden under a muffler, and the lead from this microphone goes down my trouser legs and down into the gutter and away to our van about 70 yards away. So, with luck, I shan't be discovered that I'm broadcasting. And one other thing, I must apologise for my voice beforehand, but I do hope you'll recognise the tune. So, now, in a second, I'm just going to walk out there, out into the street.
On the actual night, it's very difficult to believe it nowadays. I had no producer. I had to hold my microphone, whatever I was doing, riding a horse bareback, lying under a train, whatever it was, and a stopwatch in the other hand or hung around my neck, so I had to keep my own time. And so it was a very easy production in that sense, but of course one had to get the thing right because it was live.
Pack up your troubles in your old kit bag and smile, 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 while you've a Lucifer to light your back. Thank you, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Oh, of course, that's the style. What's the use of worrying? It never... Thank you, madam. And one of the old star girls has come across and given me one. I can't finish this song. I shall now go on. The crowd are just looking at me, very amazed. I'm feeling very embarrassed. I'll now try another song. It's a long way to Tipperary. It's a long way to go.
One of the advantages of the programme was it brought us into contact with the public. The BBC's always been rather behind the walls of Broadcasting House, and I was being let out among the people, so to speak.
This evening, I'm outside in the middle of the sports club, the BBC Sports Club at Moss Spur Park, and I haven't come here to play a game, I'm afraid. I've come to do a test on one of those dogs you've probably seen on the films or heard many times who are trained to deal with gunmen or people who snatch bags. And the particular dog I've got is one many listeners know. His name is Rustler, and he takes part every week in Riders on the Range. And with him, we've got Trevor Hill from the Canine Film Dogs, who's going to act a little scene with me. We're going to pretend that I go up to a young lady, who I've got here. I shall snatch her bag, and you probably hear her scream. And then I shall run off to another mic I've got about 80 yards away, and the dog will chase me, and, well, then we'll see what happens. And, by the way, I am in a padded suit, and, well, I think I shall need it. That's just a... let you know that I have got a padded suit on. Well, that's the scene, and now let's imagine I'm walking along a dark night and in a dark lane, and I meet a young lady. Good evening, miss.
Good evening. Oh! Oh! My bag! Quick! Quick! That man!
What's the matter, miss?
That man, he's taken my bag!
What's the man running?
That one, yes, quick!
Well, we can't take him, but the dog will.
Good!
Well, I've got up the other end here now, and I can see the dog coming out behind the fire box. And here he is. He's got me. He's got me on the ground. I'm lying on the ground now. And he's got me on the right arm, thank God for this padded suit. Get away. Get away, you brute. And the owner's just come up, and this dog is watching me with eyes like a hawk. He's about 3 feet away, and I'm sitting here. And believe me, if I'm in this padded suit, I should be in a bad state.
I'm a frustrated comic, for one thing, but I also like to slight show-off, really. And so I plucked up courage to do these things. But I must say, before I ever did anything, I made sure the chap I was going to do it with, or the woman, was an expert in it. So if I was going through a wall of barrels in the back of a motorbike, like I did with a chap called Mad Johnny Davis, I knew he was the top of the profession and did it regularly himself.
OK, Brian. Yes, all right, Johnny, I got my head down. I'm leaning forward into Johnny. We're going up about 100 yards away to have a run at these barrels. We're going up now. I'm clinging on, and I can promise you it's the most frightening of anything I've done. He's just turning round to get into the straight to run at these barrels. I can see him in the distance, a white pyramid, and we're off. We're going off now. 20, about 30 miles an hour, I should say. We're going. The barrels are coming. About 10 yards away. My God. Here they go. Wow.
I mean, I think one of the most frightening things I did do was this business of having this 6-inch nail with a very sharp point thrown at me by the dart champion of the world, Joe Hitchcock. And he used to have a stooge who did this. He used to go around all the pubs and halls and that. And he had a stooge who used to balance a penny on his nose, put his head back, and the penny balanced on the end of his nose. And Joe Hitchcock, with this nail, would knock off that penny. And so when I said I'd do something with him, he said, right, now we'll do the penny thing. I said, hey, not with my nose, because it's so easy to hit anyhow. And I wouldn't dare, because a penny's a tiny thing to hit with a nail. It might go through my nose. And he said, well, there's another thing. You can do it, but I stick a cigarette in each ear, and I'll knock the cigarette out of the ear. And I said, well, that doesn't sound too bad. But just funnily enough, before the broadcast, just to show I was frightened with you, I said, well, just listen to my heart beating, because I was a bit scared. And we put the microphone in my heart, and it sounded like a sort of sledgehammer going.
Well, that wasn't a native beating the tom-tom, that was my heart, and that's how I'm feeling now as I stand here talking to the microphone with my back to Joe as he has a shot, I think it's at my left ear, any moment now, and it's a nice slip, and he got it.
Good old Joe.
That was my left ear. Cigarette in my left ear, and he's now going to have one on my right, any moment now. Oh, he missed it.
Did you want to see him tremble?
He's missed it, and I am shaking. I can't. And I think he split it in half, hasn't he, the cigarette?
He's got it.
Right, well, listeners, I've been through it, and I'm now going to go and have what there is behind the counter because I feel like it. And so we say goodnight to the King's Arms and return you to the studio.
And another thing we thought we would try, which got us into a bit of trouble, we read in papers, little things, meet me under the clock at 11 and all these sort of things. We wondered, what happens? Do people actually pay attention to these little notices in the personal columns of the papers? And so we got a friend of ours who was editor of the Evening News to insert in the Evening News this little notice. Well set up young gentleman invites young ladies seeking adventure to meet him on the steps of the Criterion restaurant at 7:15 p.m. Saturday, and that was the date of the next day. Identification, blue and white spotted scarf, and code word, how's your uncle? So that was the setting. And I came down Regent Street in a taxi, and the chap saw a bit of a crowd here. So I said, well, I've got to do something from the Criterion restaurant. He dropped me in front, and outside were a posse of police, arms linked, holding back a crowd. I mean, there was no traffic. I mean, the lower Regent Street was packed. And it was very embarrassing. I went out to them and said, and they all shouted out, how's your uncle? And I interviewed some of them. They didn't seem too disappointed, though I was neither young or well set up. But that caused stampede. You won't believe it, but the People, the Sunday People, the next day, on the front page, in 2-inch type across, it said, BBC Stampedes Piccadilly, stupid stunt. And of course, there was an absolute sensation. The police weren't at all pleased. And so we had to apologise to the police. In fact, there's a letter in my file apologising on behalf of the BBC to the police. And in the end, they said, well, no more stunts like that, but if ever you're going to do anything in the street, we've got to have a policeman nearby just to see you don't misbehave.
So ends this week's In Time Tonight. We hope to bring you something interesting every week.
People did make a date with it, and it did certainly make me well-known, which or better known than I was. And the other thing it did, it taught me broadcasting, because I had to forget the microphone. As I said, I kept my own stopwatch, but I just had to talk and be natural and try and forget I was doing anything but just talking to one person sitting at home, you know, telling them what I was doing. So it was the greatest education a broadcaster could ever have.
The most chaotic Let's Go Somewhere was when Brian joined the Crazy Gang on stage at London's Victoria Palace Theatre during their barbershop sketch, with this result.
I've got all this white stuff in my eyes and my face. Ow! Nothing in my eyes. Right on the arm. Ow! Now it's all over my face. The soap's in my eyes. Oh, blimey. I hope they can hear my face. Stop getting into this. Now he's thrown me over. I'm lying on my back on the stage here. Ow! Look out, Jimmy. And now he's at my tummy. Ah! And the stage is a terrific mess here with soap all over the floor. Ow! And now I'm ready for... I've got green shampoo on my head. I don't know what colour. I've just seen... Ow! I don't know if you'll hear a single word here now because the stuff pouring through my eyes and the face...
And there was more excitement when Brian rode on a fire engine to see how long it would take to reach Broadcasting House if a fire alarm went off in the In Town Tonight studio.
They should be going, there they are, there's the alarm. That's the bang of the tram horn. I'm going down the pole now. I'm going down, I'm sliding down, you probably heard it hit the mic. I land in a heap at the bottom, crossing the floor.
BBC,
those are the doors of the station opening, I'm getting onto the engine, I'm in it. Very good start. We turn left out of the station. I'm sitting in the front of the engine here between the leading farm and who's hanging the bell, which you can probably hear. And the driver on my right. And we're coming up to a sharp right-hand bend now into Paddington Street. It's just begun to rain. This road's a tiny bit slippery. And we've got this amber light flashing in the darkness here. And it's absolute thrill as we race along here, car just gone out of the way there, pulling into the side. Just listen now as we roar up towards Marylebone High Street. Sharp left turn and then a sharp right one into Stamford Street. We have to go up here because the one-way traffic up through Stamford Street. And by the way, the other farms in the back and the ones in front here have already struggled into their helmets and their fire boots. So we're all set for the fire and we're heading down Stamford Street now as fast as we can. We're allowed to go as fast as we can in conformity with safety. And we're crossing the crossroads here. A friendly policeman waves us on and we're now coming up towards Harley Street. Listen now as we go over crossroads here into Harley Street. Slow down. down. A taxi just whizzes out of our line, and we do a lovely right-hand fast turn into Portland Place. And we're heading for home with the lights down the middle of the road here. Another car pulled away from us as we race down towards Broadcasting House. I can see the lights up there in the far corner of the road down the bottom. And the green lights of New Captain Street saying, come on to us. So listen as we go. Cross the line safely. We're coming past the car park just by Broadcasting House, and we're going to pull up there in a second. There's another car waiting outside, and we're going to pull up in front of the front door. And let's imagine that if there was a real fire, we should be leaping out now with our hoses and rushing down and with the officer and seeing what was happening in the studio and perhaps squirting all the people in it.
And it took just 2.5 minutes. One of the popular radio programmes of the time involved a nighttime journey aboard a number 3 London bus from Camden Town to the Kennington Oval, with different reporters describing the sights along the way. First stop was Brian, in the London Zoo.
I'm speaking from inside the rodent house, but the zoo itself is a very different one from what the visitors see who come here in the daytime. Outside now it's uncannily quiet, except for an occasional roar from the lions, or rather sinister howling of the wolves. The monkeys that swing from bar to bar during the day, or the sea lions that catch and guzzle those fish, and the elephants that give the children a ride, all these animals have hit the hay early and are fast asleep. One exception is one of the bears just outside here who's doing a bit of pole squatting on top of a high tree trunk, just for fun, I think. But inside here at the rodent house, the position's quite reversed. These are all nocturnal animals, and for them the day's just begun. And I'm with the porcupines at the moment, and they're having an evening meal of very nice beetroot, which is being kept back for them. And the porcupines have their prickles, black and white prickles. Just listen to them as they move about. You heard all the prickles hit then. I've got the superintendent of the zoo here, Mr. Cansdale. And what's this extraordinary animal we're looking at?
This is an aardvark, or an ant bear. He comes from East Africa. He normally eats ants, but we have to make up a substitute for him, and he's busy guzzling it now.
Listen to him, listeners. Yeah, well, he's a mixture of, I don't know what, of a pig and a kangaroo, and he's got a nose like Schnozzle Durant. Well, we're going across now to what we hope are our hot spots here, the bats. They are not English bats, they come from Africa, and they hang up down, upside down, all their life, and they look just like umbrellas which are hanging up for repair. And one of them has even got a little baby hanging to her tummy. I think the baby's not very old. Listen to them now as they chatter about. Absolute quiet from the bats. What about these bats? How long have we had them here?
They've been over here about a year. I brought some of them back, as a matter of fact, last year. And they're fruit eaters, quite different from the insect-eating bats in this country.
They're very shy, aren't they? They won't make any noise at all.
No, they're not playing up at all.
No, that's usually the way. What about this other animal on the left here? What's that one?
Oh, that's a palm civet. He's also rather noisy in the ordinary way, but he's not playing the game at all tonight.
Just a little... See, well, that's the palm civet making a noise there. And all around me are hundreds of cages with all these animals waking up, and they're really coming out, so that we are scoring over the visitor who comes here at the daytime. We can see these animals. And so from this zoo in the middle of London, this jungle of wild animals, we return you to the modern civilization of our number 3 bus.
1951 saw the Festival of Britain, with a huge exhibition on London's South Bank. Brown reported from the Polar Theatre, inside the Great Dome of Discovery.
We are in what I imagine is a perfect replica of landscape of the Antarctic, and there's a hurricane blowing, there's snow all around, and one really begins to shiver, and it is a perfect, as I say, replica of what I imagine the boys see there. Well, now, this Polar Theatre is telling the story of polar exploration and the great part that Great Britain has played in that, and such names as Shackleton and Scott, of course, come to mind straight away. And they show a film here which shows us all the new developments they've got, such as aeroplanes, mechanical aids, such as tracked vehicles and radio, but they emphasize that on the whole, still the best means of transport is the dog. And I've got here a sledge alongside me, a 12-foot sledge pulled by 9 husky dogs, and for those of you who aren't canine experts, a husky has a face rather like either an elk hound or an Alsatian, and a curled-up tail rather like a chow. And I've got with me alongside, looking after them, Jumbo Nickel, who was in the 1947-1950 Falkland Island Dependencies Survey, so he should know something about it. And we'll find out a little bit about these dogs from him. First of all, where they come from? Where are they bred?
Well, they originally came from Labrador.
Mm-hmm. And how are they trained? How do you train them?
Well, you get a nucleus of old dogs, 3 or 4 old dogs, and the mother of the puppies, and you run a pup beside the mother, and normally in a matter of a few hours, you generally get the pup running in the right direction.
That's pretty quick going, isn't it? Do they like it from the start?
Oh, yes, they're sort of born into it, and they know all about it. It doesn't take very long to get them used to it.
What sort of mileage will a dog like this do in life?
Well, that's hard to say, but old Darkie, the leader up the front, mm-hmm. he's done between 6,000 and 7,000 miles in the Antarctic.
That's terrific, isn't it? He actually was on the last expedition.
Oh, yes, he came home last year.
Well, now they must be very healthy and tough, is that so?
Well, they're extremely healthy dogs, because down south you never get any disease. There's no germs in the air. And so disease is not known. And as for being tough, well, they are tough because we don't treat them as pets. We treat them as working animals, as we've got to rely on them so much. And that nothing gets them down.
Well, now, what are the words of command? Can you give us
those?
Well,
we start off by saying, wheat dogs.
Yes.
That's to get the dogs underway and keep them going. And if you want them to go to the left, you say, irr, dogs.
Yes.
See, they get quite excited.
Yes.
And then to get them to go to the right, which is a short word of command, which is, ook, ook.
Yes.
They are now dogs.
Yes.
And to quieten them down or to stop them, you say, ah, now dogs, ah, and they should lie down or stop.
Well, can we see if it works? And can I have a shot at doing it?
Yes, by all
well,
means.
Well, now, I'm going to take up the strain on the trace here, and I pull that, and the dogs are taking the strain now, and we'll see what happens as I say, wheat, wheat! Wheat. My goodness, they're moving! What do we say to the right? Ook, 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 ook! They've gone to the right, and now, and believe it or not, those dogs have stopped, and they're nosing around a bit, but I expect if it was in the middle of the Antarctic, they'd lie down in the snow, would they? Actually,
yes.
They're trying to rush off from the stage, but they behave very well. Well, thank you very much indeed, and that does show that these words of command work and that mush-mush is only Bob Hope's word for it. It isn't the real one. So, wheat-wheat!
One of the cinematic discoveries of the 50s was Cinerama, where three projectors and a huge curved screen gave the cinema audience the feeling of actually being in the film. The opening sequence was a trip on a giant roller coaster.
And this is it. The curtains have drawn back and we've been plunged straight onto a roller coaster or switchback. We're in the front seat of the car, right from our seats in the stalls or the dress circle. And we're going up the incline now, slowly going up right into the sky above us. And we can see the full scope of normal vision. That is, we're looking right ahead. We can see miles out to sea on either side of us. We're nearly at the top. I can see all the other turns going on down there. There's a big Catherine wheel going on below us there. This is a fairground and we come to the top. We're going down the first big dip. Hold on to your armchairs at home. And now we're coming to the next drop. I think this one must be about 60 to 80 feet. It really gives one the impression of being in this front seat. We're going right down. And again. And I can promise you one's tummy's really going round and round inside one now. One really gets the impression of rushing round this roller coaster. It's meant to be the biggest one in the world. And the steepest. Here's another drop. Oh. And no longer are the audience relaxed, gripping their seats, and every now and again they're screaming as we come right round a corner now. And one gets really the impression of being in the car because one's going right through the scaffolding. It seems to go right by one. And the colour and the darkness as one goes through the scaffolding, through the tunnels. We're going under one now. And we're coming near the final bend. Thank goodness for that. I wonder how you're all feeling at home. There's just another short one coming down now. One more. And I don't know about you, but my tummy here is feeling quite upset. I can really assure you, if you come and sit here in the front row of this roller coaster, you won't feel too hot. I wonder how you at home are feeling.
In 1955, the BBC Light programme decided to revive Let's Go Somewhere, but it was to be 15 minutes long instead of the old 3 to 4 minutes. As before, the programmes would be completely live. Brown had even greater scope for practical jokes. At London's Victoria Station, he found no one paid any notice at all when he left a human skull in the left luggage office or wore a wolf mask under his hat. So finally, he tried one last trick.
Now, we're going to try something. I've been up to the station announcer's office. Now, these station announcers do, I think, a magnificent job. They usually have their legs pulled a bit in theatres and things like that, and they're always mocked and taken off. But I've been up to see Mrs. Giles, who does a wonderful job up here, so we're going to ask her to break all etiquette of announcers and just to make a rather strange announcement so that I can see whether people really pay attention to these things and whether they really listen to what's being said. Well, now, I've pinched an announcement I think Kenny Thorne and Dickie Murdoch used once, and we'll ask Mrs. Giles to give that one out now.
Now, I have a special announcement to make. Will the passengers who took the 8 o'clock train from platform 15 to Brighton kindly bring it back as we need it first thing in the morning. Thank you.
This one really has had the first reaction. Some people are all talking to each other and looking very amused and looking up where the voice came from. And I think that one really did get home, which I think does show that perhaps that announcers have their things listened to and they're not really so indistinct as they always try and make out when they take them off on the stage.
In other editions, Brown tried to give away 10-shilling notes, pretended to be a waxwork at Madame Tussaud's, and carried out a smash-and-grab raid in Nottingham. The police force there were the first in the world to have radio cars. Only a senior police officer knew that Brown wasn't for real.
I've got about 80 yards to before I turn round into a one-way street, and then I'm going up to the jeweller's shop. I've got a black cosh with me, a nasty-looking weapon, and I'm going to break the glass with that. It's a thin layer of snow on the ground. I'm going out in this main street now, looking to my right, it's all right, and I'm drawing up, and I'm stopping the car now, I'm putting on the handbrake. Now, there's no one about except one man in a Homburg who hasn't looked very suspicious, and I'm just going to lift the door out. I'm going out with my microphone and this cosh. I'm going out now, I've got the microphone lead behind me, and there's an alleyway, and I'm going up, and there's a door, and it's got a small pane of glass in it, and I'm going to smash this pane of glass, and through that pane of glass I can see a very nice silver cup. Now, I'm going to cosh it in a minute, and you'll hear it, so just stand by, wait for me. And I put my hand through, I've got a silver cup, and I'm running back into the car now. The lead's behind me, there's a man walked by there, looked a bit surprised. I put it in the back there, and I'm going to go off in a second. We're just getting the lead in after me. Ted Castle has just put another microphone over me so that I can talk while I'm driving, and I'm going to be off now. Yes, I'm off. I'm going straight up. It's a one-way street, and I've got George Street just ahead of me, and I'm going to turn across up there to the left. I've got about 20 yards to go before that. I wonder if I'm going to get away.
Police Department. Hello, this is Nehorai, Tenham Silversmith Company, 25 Pelham Street. I had just now a man who smashed the window and grabbed the silver cup and ran away. I ran after his car, and the only number that I could get was L-U-W.
Hello, NYC. Hello, M2NYC from M2NY. Message number 43, code A, begins. Action 4. Smash and grab, jeweller's shop, 25 Pelham Street. Stolen a silver cup. Thief made his getaway in a motor car. Registered number, L. Lucy, U. Uncle, W. William.
Right, well, we've made pretty good time at the moment. I've just got out onto the main Mansfield Road. I'm getting a bit skinny on this road. There's a lot of loose snow on it, but we've done good time. I'm afraid to say we just shot one traffic light then, but we made quite sure it was quite clear coming the other way. But we're skidding a lot here, and I'm passing a car here. I haven't seen any sign of a police car yet. Touch wood, I can't see anything yet. We're going along a steady 40 miles an hour. It's about as much as I can do downhill in this weather at the moment, because it's snowing against the windscreen now.
Contact a stolen motor car, L. Lucy, U. Uncle W. William, travelling along Mansfield Road away from the city, now at the junction with Hucknall Road, 11 over.
We've just heard that there's a car behind. I can't see through myself. Yes, I can see it. It's on our tail. Ted Castle just gave me a tap, and he was waiting at that road there, and he must have sighted me. We kept as look much as we could behind another car, but I'm afraid they spotted me. There goes the siren. He's coming up behind me. He's trying to cut across in front of me. He's running alongside me. I'm not going to stop. I'm going to force him to do something. I'm not going to stop. I'm keeping behind this car in front of me, so either the front car will stop or this police car's got to get in behind me because another car's coming up towards him. I'm going on because I don't think he's going to ram me. He's going to come in front of me, but I'm passing him. I'm going round him. I'm not stopping. And in fact, I've done a bit of a skid there, but it's all right. I've passed him, and he's got to come on behind me now. There's only one man in that car, remember, so the other couldn't jump out and stop me, and I've passed him.
Ignored my signal and passed me, travelling along Mansfield Road, away from the city, 11 over.
We're not very far from the border, but I don't think we're going to make it. He's coming up behind me again. This time I think he's got me. He's right in front of me. I can't. I'm stopping. Yes, I've got to stop. He's right in front. Yes. He's got me now. I can't very well go on. He's got between me and an island there. I have to stop. He's coming up in a moment. Yes, here he is. He's come out. And he's... What's he doing? He's just turning off the... He's turned off my ignition key.
You have the description of a man to enter or break a window of a jeweler's shop this evening. And this car answers the description of the car used in that attempt.
No, I'm just home. I've been playing bridge with my aunt.
Well, before you say any more, I'll caution you. You're not obliged to say anything unless you wish to do so. Whatever you say may be given in evidence.
All right, I'll keep quiet.
I'm going to arrest you and take you to police headquarters.
All right, well, there we are. Now, that is a completely fair cop. You can rest assured they would have got me. In fact, they have got me, and I would be carried off now to police headquarters.
In the original series of Let's Go Somewhere, for his 100th edition on In Town Tonight, Brian had asked for, and was given, the freedom of the airwaves to carry out one of his greatest wishes.
My wish is quite an easy one. I've always wanted to do a cross-talk act on the radio, and I'll never have a chance if I don't take this one tonight. Well, I've got my friend and colleague John Ellison here as my partner. He's going to be the straight man. I'm the comic. I wear the funny hat. Okay, off we go.
Ladies and gentlemen, tonight, by way of a change, I'm going to give you a serious monologue entitled The Orphan's Return. It was a dark, cold night in December, and the snow was falling fast. Little Nell lay in the gutter, and the rich folk by her path. You may ask me...
I say,
what is it? What do you want to come in here for? What do you want?
I've just seen 40 men under one umbrella, and not one of them got wet.
40 men under one umbrella, not one of them got wet? It must have been a very large umbrella.
No, it wasn't raining.
It wasn't raining. Now, look here. What do you mean by coming on here interrupting me while I'm reciting? Now, go away. Get out of it. I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen. I'll begin again. It was a dark, cold
night. It's all
night
in the papers tonight.
What is?
Fish and chips.
I...
We don't want London Bridge any longer.
Why not?
Well, it's long enough already.
It's long enough.
Do you know who's in the Navy?
No, who?
Sailors. I've got a coat with no nose.
Really? How does it smell?
Terrible.
I don't want to know about that. Will you get out of here?
I've got a letter here. If I post it tonight, do you think it'll get to Glasgow by Wednesday?
My dear fellow, of course it will.
Well, I bet you it won't.
How's that?
It's addressed to Shoreditch.
It seems to me you're next door to a blithering idiot.
Well, move over and give me a chance.
Oh.
By the way, I nearly saw your brother the other day.
How do you mean you nearly saw my brother?
Well, isn't your brother a policeman?
That's quite correct. He is a policeman.
Isn't he PC-49?
That's quite right. He is PC-49.
Well, I met PC-48.
You met PC-48. You may think you're very, very clever, don't you? But let me tell you, I've got a brother who, even though he was on the dole, always managed to live above his income.
Well, that's impossible. He couldn't be on the dole and live above his income.
Oh, yes, he could. He had a flat over the labor exchange. That got you, didn't it? Well, by the way, what's your brother doing these days?
Nothing.
Nothing? I thought he applied for that job as producer of In Town Tonight.
Yes, he got the job.
He got a...
they call him Button B, you know.
Button B? An extraordinary name. Why on earth do they call him that?
Well, he's always pressed for money.
Oh. Well, I must say, I don't know what your wife thinks about all this.
Well, that reminds me, he has a letter from her.
But there's nothing written on it.
No, we're not on speaking terms. Not that it matters. I've just got 6 months for rocking her to sleep.
My dear Brian, you can't get 6 months for rocking your wife to sleep.
No, yes, I can. You should have seen the size of the rock.
I should have seen it. I'm sick of this. I'm going into this restaurant to get something to eat. Now, get out of here. Here I am. Waiter, you serve lobsters?
Yes, sir. Sit down. We serve anybody here.
I see you've got frog legs.
Yes, it's all the walking about that does it.
Well, how long will the spaghetti be?
I don't know, sir. We never measure it.
You never measure it. I think I'll have some soup.
Right, sir. Here it is.
I say, waiter, there's a fly in my soup.
All right, sir, don't shout. Everyone else will want one.
Have you got any eggs?
Yes, sir.
Are they fresh?
Don't ask me, sir. I only laid the table.
Oh, this is hope, sir. I think I'll have a drink. What do you suggest?
I'd have a mother-in-law, sir.
A mother-in-law? What's that?
Stout and bitter. Terrible weather we're having, aren't we, sir?
Yes, terrible.
I call it Madam Butterfly Wedding.
Madam Butterfly Wedding?
Yes, sir.
Okay, right.
Yes, sir. One fine day.
One fine...
Oh, but cheer up. Just around the corner, maybe sunshine for you and for me.
Just around the corner, maybe sunshine for you. Just around the corner, skies above may be blue. Even though it's dark and cloudy, mist, the sun will soon say howdy. Just around the corner, from you we'll see you later. Just around the corner from you.
Yes, sir.
Band of the Welsh Guards comes the detachment from the Royal Air Force, junior of the three services. And over the heads of the Royal Air Force, we see the detachments of the armed forces of the countries of the Commonwealth.
Brown providing television commentary on the funeral of King George VI. The following year, he was again one of the team describing the procession of the coronation, and that evening broadcast from a street party in London.
And here at Camberwell, we've got a street party going now strong.
and they're going to sing Bunch of Coconuts in the best style of Camberwell. So off we go. And they're dining up in a line right across the street here, which is decorated, flags all over the place, and we've got a large crown over the top, a small stage erected in the street, and this whole Camberwell, well, you can have your Regent Streets and Oxford Street, this is decorations like real, true southeast Londoners, and they're having the time of their lives in spite of a bit of wind and rain here, and they're crowding this street, and I'm going to join in with them as they go arm in arm, so let's go over now and join in the dance. Well, look, quiet everybody a moment. We'll get Mrs. Miles to send a message to the Queen from all here at Camberwell.
From all at Camberwell, we would like to send wishes in song to our Queen. So here we go with good luck, good health, God bless you.
One of the highlights of Brown's broadcasting career was the Queen's Silver Jubilee in 1977. After a ceremony at St Paul's Cathedral, the Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh walked through thousands of cheering spectators to the Guildhall, accompanied only by the Lord Mayor and Lady Mayoress and Brown.
The Queen will start her walk about. She'll walk round the north side and we shall follow as closely behind as we can. With her at the moment is the Lord Mayor, the Duke of Edinburgh in his uniform, ramble the fleet, waving, looking up at the windows of the people, and we shall just walk round behind, and we're starting walking down the steps now, just about 20 yards away from Her Majesty, on a tremendous moment for this crowd who've been waiting. They're giving a wonderful reception. All the little children are leaning over the railings, and she's within about 5 yards of the best view many of them will ever have had of their Queen. We're within about 10 yards. The Duke of Edinburgh, as usual, laughing, making jokes, walking with the Lady Marys. And it's a really a wonderful occasion. This is what it's all about. And the Queen goes up and talks to someone in a blue anorak, a young boy there. And this must be the greatest moment of her life. She moves along, having a word with someone, taking a very close-up view. That'll be a photograph for the family album. And she now has another word with them. Balloons on the edge there, people are waving flags, the little children, everybody saying God bless you ma'am and so on. It's a very, very moving moment as she walks along, cameramen in front of her taking the pictures which you'll see in your papers tomorrow, and she stops again at a group of people. Remember, they've been here waiting for hours, and this is a moment for about five girls there she's talking to. What she's saying I don't know, but to roaring and laughter they are. And the Duke, of course, as usual, is just behind, getting a special chair for the girls there. And the Queen will go through along here into the gardens where she'll be presented with a bouquet of orchids, a replica of one presented to her at the coronation. This will be presented by the Master of the Worshipful Company of Gardeners. She pauses again. This is going to take a long time to get to Guildhall if she goes at this pace all the way. So we're going on now. We're in Cheapside. We've seen two of the aldermen presented, Sir Murray Fox and Sir Alderman Davis, and we're now catching up with the Queen. We've really been in this walkabout. It's the most tremendous sensation, the feeling of walking through the crowds here. I'm just about 5 yards behind the Queen, and I've never been in such a remarkable thing in my life, really. I'm going to stop now. I shall overrun Her Majesty. She's just talking to another group, this time a gentleman with dark hair. And the Lord Mayor just waits behind her, and she's pointing to a little chap there. I might get him. The little boy, hello there. Someone just tapped her. Hello, little chap. What did the Queen say to you? Anything?
She said, do they live here?
Do they live? She said, do they live? Do we live here?
Well, that's lovely. He's about, I suppose, 2 feet tall, that little chap. He can't be more than about 3 years old.
And it's very noticeable, everybody trying to shake hands with the Queen. She has, in fact, only shaken hands with one person, an old man in a Panama and medals, and as she left him, he was in tears. Tremendous reception as the Queen turns into King Street. This is the first view, of course, they've got. And this is a narrower street, and it echoes the flags here. This is most marvellously decorated, this street. She's talking to a group of ladies there. And it's noticeable, whenever she stops to talk to someone, there's silence, and as soon as she moves on again, up come the chairs. And I'll just edge in a little bit towards this side, hoping that the Duke of Edinburgh might have a word. So would you like to say something to the many listeners?
I can't hear myself think.
Well, there you are, the Duke of Edinburgh can't hear himself think. Anyhow, it's a magnificent scene.
For the wedding of the Prince and Princess of Wales, Brown was back at St. Paul's on Queen Anne's statue, in front of the steps that lead up to the west door. At one point he forgot himself and said the steps leading up to the pavilion. But the greatest moment was the arrival of the bride.
I can see the glass coach. It's come into view behind the military police, and when Lady Diana reaches this square just in front of the steps, there will be the most tremendous cheer, I can guarantee you. The flags are already held in the hands. They're already beginning to wave them. And it's a moment, I suppose, that all the people have been here for 3 days. This is a supreme moment until that great moment when they come out as husband and wife. The Mounted Police are just coming into the square now, the glass coach coming up the hill. It's quite a steep hill, remember. The cheering starting up like a hill. Listen to the cheering from St. Paul's. The two bay horses, Lady Penelope and Kestrel, doing a great job coming up the hill there. And you see the two footmen in their state hats and full state livery, and the coachman looking superb, Richard Boland. And inside the glass coach, we won't see yet, because they're going a little bit up towards the east, and now they'll turn right across us. Here is the cherry, the two outriders. What a welcome, and now I get my first sight of the bride. With the veil, of course, one can't see her as well as we shall when she's married, in that glass coach, waving at the crowd. And down the steps will come the two bridesmaids who will accompany. They're waiting for her now. Lady Sarah Armstrong-Jones with India Hicks. They've been escorted down by Gentleman Usher. They're waiting now, and the two outriders already on the sand, and the bride just approaching the steps. Remember, there are 24 steps she has to go up in this long train of hers. And when she gets halfway, she will pause. And we'll tell you why in a second, but in a moment, the carriage is just going to halt. It's being drawn up in front of the steps. The two bridesmaids waiting there, very excited. Lady Sarah looking absolutely charming. She hasn't got flowers on her head. And now Earl Spencer is getting out first, as fathers do, so they can help the bride. And Earl Spencer having a little bit of difficulty getting out of this rather rockety glass coach, I must admit. It's very well sprung. I hope they aren't too seasick after travelling in it. Earl Spencer there in his grey morning suit, and he's being just helped now as he's going up the steps. And here comes the bride. What a marvellous moment for her. And as she goes up the steps, there'll be a fanfare by the state trumpeters of the Household Cavalry.
Five years later, it was the turn of the Duke and Duchess of York, and Brown was on the Victoria Memorial outside Buckingham Palace as the bride and groom came out to greet the crowds.
Yes, at the moment when the Duchess of York steps out onto the balcony of the Duke of York alongside her, here she's smiling and waving to the crowd, just a couple, and in fact they are arranging the train behind her. So there she is. She's on the left as we look, on the right of the Duke of York. Every flag has ever been, I think, is being waved. The crowd are going mad. It's a marvellous sight. And just put yourself in their shoes. How wonderful it is to be to look down on this sea of faces and flags waving. And we've had shouts of "We want Fergie." And the other doors are opening. The rest of the royal family are going to come out. So all three doors are being opened. And soon the balcony will be full of the royal family, with the centrepiece, of course, the Duchess of York. She turns inside and she looks at the moment as the Queen joins them, and all the little pages and bridesmaids come. You can just see their heads looking over the top of the canopy. They're waving like mad. There's Prince William waving, and they're all having a marvellous time waving there to the crowd. And Major Ferguson has come out there without his grey top hat. I don't think he's had one all day, but he's got that lovely old coat of his on still, and he's standing there. And there's the bride's mother is there with her as well. Mrs. Barrantes, looking marvellous in yellow. And all assembled, all the royal family are coming out there. And in the centrepiece, there's a supporter, Prince Edward just behind, the Queen Mother, and the whole family. The Queen Mother looking marvellous there. She's looking down the crowd. And I don't know, we haven't had the kiss yet. I'll let you know if it's going to be one. They're pointing up to somewhere, no doubt, to someone right up the top. There's some people right up the top of the... Oh, no, they're pointing at an airship. The dirigible is coming, and now they're looking at each other as if, shall we, sharply? The Duke of Edinburgh is saying something to one of the little pages. Captain Mark Phillips smiling, Princess Anne is there in yellow. And it's a lovely scene, a family scene, just a wedding, and being enjoyed by millions watching on television, millions, I hope, listening on radio. And there, Sarah is putting her cupping her ear, saying, "What are you shouting to me? I can't hear." I think, there's a kiss, there it is. He's got it. A very good kiss. And I notice that his nose is on the left of hers. Couples kiss in a different way. And his nose is on the left as they kiss them. But the royal family are going into breakfast. They're all shouting at him. Prince Edward's gone, and a little fair-haired page waves there. I think that's probably Andrew Ferguson gave a wave then. And the couple are going to be left all there. One of the little sailors just popping back there. Seamus, I think it was. And the couple are left now on the balcony alone, waving to the crowd, holding up the bouquet. She is. And finally, she picks up her tray. He takes her by the arm, helps her down. I notice the Queen Mother's inside, waiting to give her a hand. She comes down, and her father also greets her. And the Duke of York and the Duchess disappear inside the palace. So let's once again wish them a very, very happy life, and incidentally, a very good wedding breakfast.
From his earliest days at the BBC, Brown loved to take part in panel games and quiz shows. In the early 50s, he was chairman of a radio quiz called What's It All About, and a regular panellist on the children's TV series Ask Your Dad. Then in the 60s, he started a new quiz, Sporting Chance.
For the last 12 weeks in the Light programme, teams representing the three services have been competing for the Sporting Chance Trophy of 1962. Tonight, the Royal Navy and the Royal Air Force meet in the final. As usual, the question master is Brian Johnston.
Hello and welcome to the final of Sporting Chance, which tonight comes from the Concert Hall in Broadcasting House, London. The two teams come from the Royal Navy and the Royal Air Force. The Royal Navy are represented by Home Air Command and the Royal Air Force by Bomber Command. Now, the Royal Navy have won the toss and they've put the Royal Air Force into bat first. I put the questions alternately to the captains of each team who select who should answer. The answer must start within 10 seconds, otherwise you'll hear... and they get no marks. But for a correct answer, they'll get two. And the questions once again have been set by Roy Webber, who also acts as umpire and timekeeper.
Sporting Chance was so successful, it soon transferred to television and was followed on radio by Treble Chance. Brown was also a frequent guest panellist on 20 Questions, and in 1975 joined the team full-time when the programme was relaunched with a new team and a new question master, Terry Wogan.
Hello, let's welcome our band of plucky triers. Anona Wynn, Brian Johnston, Bettine LeBeau and William Rushton. Game to the last. And the last with the leather larynx, Greta Gourier, is ready and waiting in anticipation for me. to say that the first object is animal or vegetable or mineral or abstract or animal, vegetable and mineral, for goodness sake.
Conjugal bliss begins in a honeymoon suite. A honeymoon suite.
Animal, vegetable and mineral.
Transport.
Never.
A place?
Yes, a place.
Only one?
No, several. Many, millions.
Where you do physical training, where you do drilling exercises.
Well, as I often say, Bettine LeBeau, each to his own.
It's just something to do with the dentist.
It's nothing to do with the dentist.
Does drill come into it at all?
No, it doesn't. No, it depends on the kind of person you are, but certainly, as far as I was concerned, drilling never came into it.
But it's enjoyable place.
It's a lover's nook, a lover's glen, a lover's...
How many words on the card, then?
Now, Anona Wynn, right, lovers come into it. You've had seven. How many words on the card, Bettine LeBeau? Three, including the indefinite article.
Now, we've got to find a lover's what, haven't we?
No, the word lover is not on the card.
Oh, does a sort of embrace or kiss come into the
Oh, a great deal. There's a great deal of that in the object on the card.
Oh, a boudoir.
How can you make three words out of a boudoir?
I beg your pardon, yes.
Well, I mean, is it indoors? I thought we were outdoors.
Again, it depends on you, but...
I mean, you can do this thing anywhere, can you?
You've had 11. No, the object in the card is definitely indoors. We didn't establish whether it was outdoors or indoors.
What was that? You'd know.
The chair.
Is it upstairs or downstairs? Yes.
Upstairs. Unless you live in a bungalow.
It's an upstairs. Oh, do you mean it's a bed?
A double bed.
Never. I would think a double bed is certainly a requisite.
A
bridal suite.
Yes, that's very
right. It's a bridal suite.
Honeymoon.
Peace, my child.
Honeymoon.
It is a honeymoon suite.
I was trying to bring romance back in after the aggressive double bed from Johnson.
Yes,
you said there was no drill about it. No drill.
Well, I know you to be a public school boy, and it's a bit different for you chaps, but we never went in for any drilling.
You have to stand to attention.
I've often wondered what they taught in Eton. Marching up and down in the bed in the honeymoon suite, is that it? Now, before this gets out of hand or even dirty, it's Brian solo.
No, no.
Oh, good.
Good luck.
My favorite moment. I always enjoyed this.
You're on your own and no nudging of Bettine during this. Abstract or animal it is, Brian.
Thanks for that.
Brian's solo is a happy medium. A happy medium.
Now, this is abstract... Abstract or animal, Brian?
Right, well, now, I'm going to go for the animal. Is the animal human?
Well, you may go for the animal if you like. It's human, yes.
How many words on the card?
Three, Brian, including the indefinite article.
And you aren't very keen on the human, but is the human...
Well, it's somewhat whimsical.
Is this a title of a book?
It isn't, Brian.
Is it a saying, a well-known saying?
Yes, it is.
Is it a nice saying?
Yes.
Has someone said this to you sometime recently?
Well, they don't say it in itself. If somebody came up and said this to me, I should think they were absolutely bananas. Because on its own, it doesn't mean a cotton-picking thing.
And just to recap, it's a blank blank.
It's a blank blank, and it would make up part of a sentence. But in itself, it is a little bon mot.
Does it describe the human? I mean, is this...
No. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, it does.
It does describe
but
it.
But I said, bear in mind that there's a touch of whimsy.
Yes. I mean, no, I wouldn't like to suggest there was anything to do with the fairies, but I mean, is that sort of whimsy?
Well, you're not that a million miles off when you're talking about fairies or... No, why should I help you anymore?
No, I don't know.
You nearly slipped out that time. You've had eight.
Would I come across this in my particular job, this...
I would say
is it
that
something
I would say that you, in your particular job, epitomize it.
Epitomize it? Well, now, my job can be commentating or interviewing. Is it more on the interviewing side of talking to people?
Not necessarily.
Would it be more the commentating, describing what is going on?
Not necessarily.
Thank you very much indeed. Would it be anything to do with quiz shows like 20 Questions?
Nothing is anything to do with quiz shows like 20 Questions. No, I would say that in your commentating, certainly, you would epitomize the object on the card. You've had 12. Am I confusing you?
Is a sort of part of a sex on the card, like gentleman or man or...
No.
Sort of nothing. It's not a something gentleman or...
No, I'm sorry. We weren't able to get you anything sexual at all.
I like that.
Well, that's all right. This is very tricky, isn't it? In my particular job. Is it anything to do with talking, then?
No.
Nothing.
Well, yes, it is something to do with talking. But I don't want you to run away with the idea that it's enunciation or anything like that. It's a certain quality. Abstract.
Like, it can't be anything to do with... It's nothing to do with humour or fun or jokes or anything like that.
Well, one of the words on the card certainly is synonym.
What's with fun? I mean,
for
some...
fun...
Sin is fun. Fun.
No, never mind the sin. No, sin or near.
But the word fun isn't on the card.
The word fun isn't on the card. Give me another word for fun.
Another word for fun. well, enjoyment or joy or...
Now, you've had 18.
Oh, yeah. Another word for fun. I've had a great deal of fun today. I've enjoyed it. I've had a marvellous time.
So how are you? How do you feel?
I feel fine.
You've had 19, right?
Well, now where have I got to?
I think so far we've managed to establish that it's a something, something.
Yeah, I know we have.
I say, if you've had fun today, something you are. I am today.
A happy fellow.
Yeah! Oh.
Is that right?
In 20, you've got a happy fella, and it turns out to be a happy medium. I think you did well, Brian. That's a difficult one. The animal, when I said it was whimsy, is he a happy medium? A successful communicator with the world beyond. A prudent or sensible middle course was what I said you epitomised right. In your commentary.
Very good.
Your interviews.
I'm very biased, in fact.
I know, but I felt a little bit of crawling wouldn't be out of place.
Brown didn't fare much better when it came to sporting questions. On Games People Play, he appeared with Pete Murray, Clement Freud, and Peter West.
Here's a fascinating commentary, Brian, from 1939, and I think it might help you if you listen to the players' names or even titles. So what's the sport?
And the score is 5-all. In goes the ball again, and Guinness gets it, hits a fine shot right up into the middle, but Dorney is there. Dorney is there to save it, written by Robinson. Dorney's made his backhander very well, and the Maharaja has passed it right on to Guinness. Away goes Guinness with the ball, and a beauty he's made. A beautiful shot, right in the middle. Looks like a goal to the world, and it is.
Commentator,
it was a wonderful afternoon. I was sitting on the lawn in a chair watching this game, and you could hear the hooves of the horses as they went over the hard turf. There was Lionel Guinness playing number one. He was a very good striker of the ball, and this was the World Polo Championship. And this was polo, and it was played, and I can't remember where it was played, at Ranelagh, I think, or Hurlingham. It was a marvellous match.
India against the world, that's
yes,
right.
Yes, and that was a very good Indian commentator. It was the Maharaja Vizianagaram.
The commentator was Major Phipps Hornby.
Well, he put on an Indian accent for it. It was very good.
Which football league club was formed by the employees of the P&O shipping line?
P
P-N-O.
P-N-O.
Well, where do they sail to? I mean, the...
The Orient!
The Orient! Yay! Right!
Leslie Grave is one of the directors, isn't he? That's right, The Orient. Yes. Fine.
And here's
side.
Another question, which I know you would have been most upset if it hadn't come your way. Who won the only swimming medal for Great Britain in the Mexico Olympics?
In the Mexico one?
Mm-hmm.
Will he...
Or won't he? No.
No, I mean, no. Will he be well known to everybody, I was going to say? what's the other chap's name, then? Has he got a name called Brown, something?
No, not Brown.
Tell us, put us out of our misery.
The name was Martin Woodruff.
Sorry, Martin.
No, it was rather a tough one. Yeah. Right. What famous double did Kitty McCain complete in 1924?
She's a wonderful lady. She's still alive. She's aged over 80. And she won the Wimbledon singles.
Right.
And she beat Helen Mills. And she, of course, went on to win the ladies' doubles. So we're very proud of her that year.
Well, I'm not so proud of you because you've fallen down on the second half.
No, well, it was the mixed doubles she won, actually.
No, well, that's not right either.
No. The ladies' doubles.
No, we said the ladies.
Oh, we did, we?
What else could she win? The men's doubles.
Singles.
I shall give you half a point for that. She subsequently went on to win the All England Badminton Championship.
Excellent.
Right. Where were the 1928 Olympic Games held? Brian Johnston.
We remember that.
He's done it again.
You pressed Paris 1924.
And you couldn't be more wrong. Hmm? What? Oh, Paris 1924.
I'll give you the suspense. 1936, it was Berlin. And
right.
If we come back to 1928.
Where was it in 1932? Not that it matters.
1932, it was Los Angeles.
Right.
And 1928, and we all know the answer to that.
Amsterdam.
Clement Freud said Amsterdam.
He would.
Well, I mentioned all the others, there's nothing left for him.
Well, I do. Now, ladies and gentlemen in the audience, do you think that Brian Johnston deserves one for getting the other three Olympics?
Yes!
Another panel game Brian enjoyed was quote-unquote. And in this special Christmas edition, he's joined by Sue McGregor, P.D. James, and the programme's presenter, Nigel Rees.
Brian Johnston, the one aimed at you. This phrase was by no means coined this year, but it was recalled for a special reason. What was the reason?
So what we're watching here is a clear case of man's inhumanity to man.
Yeah, well, this is a very famous one, and thank you for giving it to me, because it was made by the great broadcaster of cricket of all time, John Arlott. It was referring to, there was a chap called Tufty Mann, who bowled slow left arm for South Africa, and he clean bowled George Mann with a very good ball, and John Arlott, who was on tour with MCC, coined this marvellous phrase, man's inhumanity to man. And that was it.
Right. I'll give you one mark, Brian. The original phrase, anybody any idea? I mean, obviously it's an old thought, but who put it in that form? Anybody know for an extra mark?
Would it be Pope?
Not Pope.
Or Dryden, perhaps?
Not Dryden. Mm-hmm. Between Pope and Dryden and John Arlott. Sort of midway.
Man's humanity makes something... Robbie Burns.
Robbie Burns, yes.
Robbie Burns, yes.
Well done. You get your mark there, Brian. Following very much on from cricket, Phyllis James, do you know who said this in 1980 and what was the occasion?
Cricket is the greatest thing that God ever created on earth. Greater than sex. Although sex isn't too bad either. But everyone knows which comes first when it's a question of cricket or sex.
Ah. Now, that was said, I think, by a playwright.
Yes.
It was said by Harold Pinter.
Yes.
And I must say, I find it a very surprising opinion, considering the beauty of his wife, still.
Well, yes.
If he'd said it on the way to the register office with me, I don't think I'd have married him. Now, I don't think it was on that occasion.
What he meant was you can play cricket and then have sex. It didn't mean the cricket came before sex as something better than the other, but he meant in time. You go out,
no,
you make...
not at all, Brian.
Yes, you make 100, you take a hat-trick, you go home, you have sex. That's
in other years, you've been famous for these sort of things. Have you committed any gaffes, foot in mouths this year?
Nothing very bad. No, I keep on being reminded of my last one I did, was when I received a letter after the West Indies had been playing at the Oval from a lady who signed herself Miss Mainpiece, and she said, we like your commentaries, you must be more careful because a lot of children listen. And when we came over, Michael Holding was bowling to Peter Willey, and you said, welcome to the Oval, where the bowler's holding the batsman's willy.
Ha 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 quite often on Quote Unquote we examine the titles of books and plays and television programs because titles like those are so often based on quotations. Sue McGregor, one of the most talked about television plays of 1980 was by Dennis Potter. Why was it called?
Blade on the Feather.
I knew you were going to ask me that, and I'm afraid I don't know.
Phyllis Jones?
Isn't it a quotation from the Ethan Boat song?
Ah, it's to do with rowing.
And, yes, and it was a play about betrayal and about, you know, the whole public school ethos.
Yeah. Brian, you must have sung this in your time.
Yes, I have, although I was a dry bob. I always used to sing that like mad.
You were a what?
A dry bob. That means I played cricket. But it didn't apply to the actual race which Eton took part in, but I heard a marvellous thing which someone heard on the towpath last year at the boat race, which is marvellous. There was a woman there, and she was talking to one of our experts, and I come every year to watch this boat race. Do just tell me one thing, she said. Why do the two same teams always get into the final? Which wasn't that.
Yes, Blade on the Feather is a rowing term which occurs in the Eton boating song, like this.
I think if you looked on the date of that record, it says the Musical Society, Eton Musical Society, 1928. And at the back there, that very nice treble voice was me.
Oh.
I was in the Musical Society. But it may not be the same one. We certainly recorded it. It was put out by His Master's Voice in those days.
Are you getting royalties?
Not yet.
Brian Johnson, do you have a remark from the year?
Well, there was a quote from Margaret Thatcher, which she gave to her ladies, who wear all these hats, you know, and they go to the conference for the ladies at the Albert Hall. And she was talking and said there are tough times ahead. And she said, ladies, she said, we've taken it lying down long enough. From now on, we must stand up with our backs to the wall, which I think is all. There was also a good remark, a friend of mine in Guildford, who spends money rather fast, and she's a lady, and she went into a Barclays bank there at Guildford the other day, and on the way in, she unfortunately met the bank manager, she got terribly flustered, and she said, oh, Mr. Smith, I'm so sorry, I keep on coming to this bank, I'm spending my water like money, which is right.
So there we are, at the end of the quiz. Let me look at the score, and by a single mark, it's a very close run thing, Brian Johnson has won. Well done, Brian.
One of radio's most popular series of recent years is I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue, which features the baffling game Mornington Crescent. A history of the game was broadcast in the 80s, called Every Man's Guide to Mornington Crescent, with this introduction to the World Championships from Raymond Baxter.
Mornington Crescent nowadays, however, is an altogether more serious affair. There is now a small band of professional players, including the I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue teams, who give demonstrations of the game and also participate in a series of sponsored competitions. Far more prestigious than those, however, is the amateur circuit, culminating each year in the World Championships. Last year, these championships were held in Reykjavik, and as usual, Radio 3 broadcast street-by-street commentary. As you'll remember, the final was a taut contest between Egypt's Ahmed Kazir and the defending champion Finland's Stig Snorgenborg. The commentator on this brief extract is Brian Johnston, with statistical analysis from Bill Frindle.
And good morning to our Radio 3 listeners. You join us on a bright, crisp morning in Reykjavik, and although the forecast has threatened some rain later in the day, this shouldn't interfere with the play too much here inside the hall. And now the champion is about to open the proceedings. He's leaning into the table with that fine aggressive action of his.
The Angel Islington.
The Angel Islington. That's remarkable. I don't think I ever remember the Angel being used as an opening gambit in the World Championship before. Perhaps the bearded wonder would check that for us. It certainly rocked Ahmed Kazir back on his heels. It immediately puts him in nip and cuts off his hindquarters in the sudden intersection.
Brian, the Angel has been used once before in the Karachi final of 1972.
Islington High Street's been used three times.
Oxford Circus.
Oh, and that's a jolly fine response from Ahmed. He's using Junkin's progression, which opens the game to suburban bidding and allows him to make a lateral shift in two.
On the Mar Street.
Oh, that's a mistake. It gives a chance to Ackers.
B Street.
And he's missed it. We have to put that down as a chance. If Ackers had said Lansdowne Road, he'd have deployed a triple Helsinki, foreclosed the Circle Line, and reversed loop to Mornington Crescent in one.
And that would have been the second fastest win this season after Humphrey Littleton's victory in the third round of the Mitsui Sonic Classic.
And now Stiggers is wiping his brow with relief.
And that's the move he's not made since the second round of the 1981 finals in Tokyo.
Fentonville Road.
Oh, and he's come out with Huguenot's Gamble. What audacity.
Downing Street.
And Ackers has conceded. There's no hope for anyone who moves there.
Mornington Crescent.
And it's first blood to Stiggers. And while we wait for the players to change ends, I've just got time to thank Mrs. Williams, I think it is, yes, Mrs. Williams of Leeds, for the rarely delicious chocolate cake she sent us.
Brian, in fact, that's the 15th cake we've received this year, and that's only two less than our world record of 17 cakes during the 1982 championships.
And Stig Snorgenborg went on to take the title for the third year running.
Finally, the show which for his last 5 years became one of the most popular of Brian's career.
We present Trivia Test Match. It's questions of trivia, it's the laws of cricket, and its umpire is Brian Johnston.
Thank you very much, and welcome to another in our series of one-day matches in which two teams try to find answers which are trivial. And we're continuing our world tour 1993, and today we've travelled by cabin cruiser, quite tricky on the M2, I can tell you, to pay a return visit to Mepham Cricket Club in Kent.
The regular team captains were Tim Rice and Willie Rushton, and here they're joined by Bernard Cribbins and Barry Cryer.
Right, we might go on, shall we? Yeah. see if this is contained in your brain. Which group of stores was well known for having billiard balls above their shops?
I think that should read billiard...
Brokers.
Or billiard halls.
Billiard halls. Yeah.
I've got to be fair to the question.
Would you like to pitch your tent somewhere else?
No, I've got to be fair to Malcolm, who sent the question. Written here is billiard halls. I didn't see how a hall could be above a shop, but I can see what
you mean. You made a real halls up of that.
Anyhow, let's have the question. Which group's in a billiard hall?
How's that?
Halls above.
How's that?
Woolies, Woolworths.
No.
How's that?
I'll take the appeal.
Burton's the Tailors.
Burton's the Tailors did. So, Willie, you've lost a wicket. You're 2-for-1, and you get the batting because of that successful appeal.
What a great vice captain. We'll go for a single.
What happens on average 37 million times a year?
Look at all these smiling faces.
Don't you wish it could?
Tony Slattery.
37 million times a year.
Yeah.
Like people giving birth.
No.
Not 37 million times a year.
You never know.
They're
doing Mepham.
Any appeals?
Lightning striking.
No, I don't think you're going to... The answer is your heart beats. You have 37 million a year.
No, that's not true.
No, you do.
No,
well, we're going for another four.
Another four, because we're doing well.
What does macerate mean in cooking?
It's to shred or tear to pieces. And...
Really?
Yes.
So you're a funny sort of cook, you are. No appeal? No.
Take meat and lay it on a bed of rice.
Tim?
Just a thought.
Yeah. I take it there wasn't an appeal.
It didn't an appeal, no.
The answer is to soak in liquor or syrup.
Oh,
that
really?
Is to macerate.
Yes.
Well, we'll go back to a single, I think.
Which was the first British hatchback car?
Hatchback.
It was one of the Austins.
Yes, 1100, is it?
No, A40.
Very good indeed. Yeah. Absolutely right. That's a very well run single. What a brilliant single. One ball to go to the overtime.
I once drove an A40 while I was completely macerated. We'll have a single, I think, please, Brian.
Yeah, well, what is Mother Teresa's first given name?
Mother.
given name?
Oh, Teresa.
Mother Teresa's first given name?
Tracy.
Oh, very, very good. You're very near. The answer is Agnes.
Another four, please. Stay as simple as the last one.
What did the Matrimonial Clauses Bill of 1923 permit for the first time?
Oh, you're getting the rude ones down.
No, this is...
undressing in bed. What do you think it is?
What?
Divorce.
I'm going to give it to you. Yeah. It allowed wives to divorce their husbands for... Just tell me what for.
For
undressing in bed.
Yes, that would go with it. Adultery is the answer.
Yes, yes, that'd be one. Thank you.
I know a woman who divorced her husband for having flat feet. He kept on putting him in the wrong flat. Do you remember that one? Well, the old ones are best. Oh,
yes, nice to hear them again, Brian.
Right.
We basically got that.
Some of these jokes are so embarrassing, I was in them. He is the man with flat feet.
Who got the batting, Willie?
That was so successful, that last four we got. We did get a four just then, didn't we?
Oh, yeah. What were buffalo chips?
How's that?
You use the barbecue, aren't they?
How's that?
Yes. I wouldn't advise you to
use
the
barbecue. How's that?
No, a pair of trousers. Nice trousers.
How's that?
Yeah. Go on, then.
I'm hearing an appeal, yes.
They were actually the buffalo cow pats, which were dried and used as fuel by the American Indian.
Can you see the answers from where you are? The answer is buffalo dung burned for fuel.
Buffalo
You've gone
chips.
Up to 48.
And another four. Let's go to half century.
American angler Franz Kurtz has made a fortune selling what? K-E-R-T-S-K. He's made a fortune selling.
A bait additive, a smelly thing that you rub on your bait.
What do you rub on your bait?
I don't know what it is. I've never used it. It's an attractor for fish.
Well, yeah, I suppose I must give it to you. Cans of worms. I mean, you know, which are...
No, I'm sorry. I can't accept that, Ryan. I can't accept it. I'm sorry. I think you're being too kind.
All right, I'll...
All right, we'll add it.
Hang on. Hang on, I'm going to call up the third umpire.
Right.
Wrong, right. So your score stays at 48.
We'll have a single then.
How long can a pauper stay underwater without breathing?
A pauper?
A pauper. Or alternatively,
hang on.
This government's really working on it now.
We all of us have to face challenges from time to time in our lives. And my biggest one, so far as broadcasting goes, came in March 1972. One Thursday, I went to Broadcasting House as usual, and there I heard the very sad news that my old friend and colleague, Franklin Engelman, known to everyone as Jingle, had died suddenly in the night. He just recorded A Down Your Way for the next Sunday, but another one had to be recorded by somebody on the following Wednesday for the next week's programme. It wasn't long before it was decided that that somebody would be me. It was a daunting prospect. Jingle had endeared himself to millions of listeners in the 20 years or so that he'd been doing Down Your Way with Phyllis Robinson as his producer. He was Down Your Way, and Down Your Way was Jingle. So as I journeyed to Hyde in Derbyshire for my first programme, I felt very diffident and humble, not normally perhaps my most typical characteristics. Anyhow, as I found so often in my career, people were very kind, and I just managed to get by and received many friendly and encouraging letters from the regular listeners, and have done so ever since. It's a lovely programme to do. Some people call it square, and I don't disagree with them. You see, whenever we go to a place, we try to find out the nice things about it. We don't look under the carpet for scandal or anything controversial. We're always told what a wicked and selfish world we live in. But you come round with me on Down Your Way, and you'll be amazed at how many good people there are whose main object in life is to help others. It really is inspiring to find out how much they do either for their towns or villages where they live, or for the people in them. There are the many characters we find, people who are remembered by the listeners long after they've forgotten all about the place. Like Amy Cook, postwoman at Wootton-under-Edge in Gloucestershire. We had more letters about her than about anyone else for a long time. I asked her how long she'd been a postwoman.
Is that me, her?
And do you go around on a bike?
No, on Shanks's pony.
What sort of time do you have to get up, then?
I get up 5 hours.
Mm?
Then I come downstairs, put the kettle on,
mm-hmm.
and the rasher wagon.
Rasher wagon? What's that?
The frying pan.
See.
Then I'd have myself 2 eggs mm-hmm. and 2 rashers of bacon.
Okay.
Then I'd leave home to walk to the post office because I can't ride because my bike got 2 punctures in where somebody trimmed the edge along Cum Road.
Right.
But as long as I had to get to the post office at 10 to 6,
mm-hmm.
and then from 10 to 6 to 7, I'm sorting the letters, and then at 7 o'clock, I'm out on me round on Shanks's pony.
I suppose it's the variety of people we meet which makes it such fun to do, and of course, the occasional famous or well-known people we come across. When Phyllis Roberts and I went to Chalfont St. Peter, we visited the house of a Scottish gentleman who gave the listeners this clue as to his identity.
Add on, Captain Mannering. I hope this is no another of these stupid jokes about Celts. After all, us Scots don't make jokes about bowler hearts, do we?
Well, you probably know him as Private Fraser, and here in his private life he's known as John Laurie. John, very nice to see you.
Well, it's lovely, lovely to have you here, my dear man.
How long have you been in Chalfont St. Peter?
31 years, I think, this year.
Well, how have you kept your Scots accent all this time?
It's come back. As an old man, one reverts. I'm yeah. sure you'll notice it among your friends. The old Scotsmen begin to, oh, hi, and they begin to talk like that. As they get older, perfectly respectable Englishmen suddenly discover that they really have got Scottish roots. The Scottish roots come out.
I wish you could have seen his flashing eyes as he said that. I suppose we tend to interview more elderly people than young, because obviously they know more about a place and its history, and have also usually had time to do more with their lives. At Radcliffe-on-Trent, we went to see Mrs. Emily Brewster, aged 100. She was as bright as a cricket, alert and full of fun, a fine old lady. I asked her if she'd received a telegram from the Queen on her 100th birthday.
Oh, yes. But I don't know where it is. It's been put away.
Oh, is it?
Oh, it's oh, been dear. Put away to safe, yes.
Oh, yes,
I think that's a very nice thing, but it wasn't her writing, you know.
Wasn't it?
Oh, no.
Oh, I thought she wrote them herself.
No, I don't think. I think she used to do.
Hmm.
Because she's like the rest of us. She gets a bit older and I think she gets fed up.
Perhaps.
I bet she does. I should.
Just looking back again on your 100 years, I mean, do you think you've led a happy life?
Yes. Yes. Yes, taken all together. Your husband and children, and I'd go to work, and I went to work in the fields in the war, in the First World War, of course, I went to work in the fields. Get potatoes up and plant seed potatoes and all the rest of it. Well, I was all right. I was happy enough. I can remember first day I went to service, anyway.
Can you?
That was when I was 12 in the February, and I went the next September.
Age 12 and a half, I old.
Yeah, yes.
And when you say you're in service, what were you? Were you a maid or a cook
yes,
or what?
Yes, yes, general.
Mm-hmm.
General. My first place was a little grocery shop in Grantham.
Mm. Well, it sounds to me you've worked jolly hard in your life, haven't you?
Yes, didn't kill me anyway. I never ailed anything from working.
Have you always been a friendly person? I mean, do you like your neighbours and all that sort of thing?
Yes, I've always been agreeable with my neighbours, but I like to be friendly, but I don't believe in running from one house to the other.
No.
You know, gossiping and all the rest of it's all right, but you can't do your work and see to your house and gossip as well, you know.
Do you go out quite a bit now, or
no,
not?
I don't go out very much at all. Mm. But I like Sundays, I do.
Do you?
I do. Always have done, ever since I can remember. And that's 30 years ago.
Do you go to church every Sunday?
No. I don't think I've been this year, no. I thought I hadn't, oh dear me, and I only just got to go across the road. Oh, it's awful. I used to go regularly to the Mothers' Union. Of course, I'm a member of that, been a member several years. In fact, I forget where I was a member of the Mothers' Union first. I think it was when we was in the regiment, because I've been in the regiment, you know.
Yes, now which regiment was this?
First Lincolnshire, yes.
And your husband was in the regiment?
In the regiment,
and,
yes.
And where did you go with the regiment?
Well, I went to India.
Did you?
Oh, yes, yes, I went to. I had two daughters born in India.
Mm.
We were sort of in the middle of Madras and Bombay, Secunderabad.
Yes.
It was a very, very nice life. Mm. Very comfortable. Mm. Of course, you can make your life comfortable anywhere, can't you?
Do you know how many grandchildren you have? Have you ever counted?
About 19, something like
about
that.
About 19?
Yeah, something like that.
And did you have a big birthday party when you were 100?
No, not particular.
Well, there's no doubt in my mind that you are happy and that you always have been, right?
Yes, I've had me ups and downs and little bits of trouble and... But, as I say, I'm still here to tell the tale.
You don't feel any older, do you?
No.
Yeah?
I often wonder if they've made a mistake and I'm about 24.
We better check the birth certificate, hadn't we?
You never know, you know.
Yeah. We come across a lot of unusual jobs and trades in Down Your Way. A typical example was at Montgomery in Powys, Mid Wales. In Prince's Street, there was a small shop which we were told belonged to Harold the Saddler. His real name turned out to be Harold Davis, and in addition to saddlery, his other job was a hedging mitten maker. So I asked him who used hedging mittens these days.
For farmers, for pletching their hedges and tying in their hedges and general work around the farm.
Are you one of the few people who make them?
I wouldn't say I'm the only one, but I presume I am one of the only ones left.
Well, I put them on. They're very tough. They obviously will last. What are they actually made of?
Cowhide, which is a special chrome tannin.
And the stitching?
Oh, thong stitching, all by hand.
How many do you turn out a week or a year?
Oh, that's the question. Everybody asks that. And I tell them all different. Oh, I suppose I make a couple of 100 pair a year. I should say a couple of hours it takes to make a pair, but I'm interrupted very often, like, you know, and I just don't know. I go on slogging on.
Yeah. And where do you sell them to?
All around the country, chiefly to ironmongers and agricultural merchants.
They're very big, aren't they? Plenty of room inside.
Yes, make them in different sizes. All sizes, all sizes. Never stick to really one pattern, like.
Is hedging quite an art? Is it a difficult thing to do?
Oh, yes, it is an art. You ask the hedgers, they'll tell you whether it's an art or not. We're very fortunate in Wales that young farmers still do take an interest in it, and they're very proud of it. Unfortunately, in other parts, the hedge cutters, they've taken over from the pletching, but they'll always be hedging done.
And the object of these gloves is, what, to stop the big thorns getting in?
Yes, keep the thorns out.
Well, your shop is very small, isn't it?
Yes. There isn't a lot of room, but it's sufficient for what we require.
What sort of customers do you have down there?
Oh, all sorts. Get a joke a day, a laugh every day there is. One particular local farmer come in, take size 12 in boots. And he got these boots on, they were like canal barges on him. And he stumped round the shop and I thought, I'd better get him out from here before he goes through into the cellar. Anyhow, he said, I'll take him, I'll leave him on, you can repair the others. And I dashed to move the counter, what you doing? I said, moving the counter for you to go out, don't bother. He said, I'll back out, he said.
One other thing, looking at the mittens, they're very strong. I mean, do all your things last a long time?
Yes, too long. Too long, Mr. Johnson.
Too long?
Ah, too long, that's why I'm poor. I repaired some the other day, 25 years I made them, 25 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I should say the average age where they use them, the average length of time is about 5 years, I should say.
What about the other things you make?
Oh, cow kicking straps and anything for the farmer that he wants. It was my pleasure a few years ago to make a lot of hobbles, cow hobbles and cattle hobbles, horse cow hobbles for export to Canada.
What's a hobble?
Oh, for hobbling horses, to get them down to clean their feet and things like that, and cows.
Really?
Yes, they put them around their 4 feet and hobble them.
Yeah?
And then they clean their feet.
Really?
Yes.
Never heard of that. You've got some belts here now, are they good?
Yeah, yes, I got some belts, yes. Talking about belts, a fellow was partly undressing himself in the pub the other night, and I said to my son-in-law, look at him. He said, what's he doing? I said, he's going to show me his belt, I said. Look here, Saddler, he said. Look at this belt. You made it for me, Dad, 40 years ago. Oh, my God.
That's why you're poor.
That's why I'm poor. 40 years ago.
When up in Scotland at Inverness, we couldn't resist the chance of making our own investigation into the Loch Ness Monster. So we went to Loch Ness, and about halfway along the loch we found a caravan and a hut, and inside was Frank Searle. He told us that this was the Loch Ness Investigations and Information Centre, and that he'd been studying the Loch Ness monster for 10 years.
I got interested in the Loch Ness scene through coming on holiday, and on one side of this story, there are 1,400 years of written records to say that there are some larger-than-usual animals in this lake. On the other side of the story, the British media making rather a joke of it. So, was it a joke, or was it what 1,400 years of history indicated? I decided to find out for myself. So, in 1969, I pitched a tent on the loch side. I lived in a tent for 6 years, winter and summer, on an army pension of about £13 a week, and spent all my time out on the loch in a boat with cameras, and I found out for myself.
And what did you find out?
I found out that these animals do certainly exist. There's a breeding herd of them. I've seen two small ones together. The animals resemble the prehistoric plesiosaur more than anything I can come up with. They're an animal with a small head, long neck, large bulky body, four flippers. Not as big as the monster impression gives, perhaps up to about 25 feet in length. They're dark grey in colour. They are fish eaters. They're purely marine creatures, not air breathing. I think if you saw Nessie for 8 seconds, you would have had a very good sighting.
Well, let's just check up now. You say a Nessie. A lot of people think there's just one. There are a lot, you reckon?
Yes, for some strange reason, the media always use the singular. But obviously, they have to reproduce. I wouldn't like to say how many there are, but lots of people have seen two together, or larger ones or smaller ones.
You keep on mentioning 1,400 years. Is this when it was first sighted?
The first records, yes. Around the year 600, the ninth bishop of Iona, a man named Adamnan, wrote a biography of St. Columba, who operated in this area. And in this biography, he makes several references to people of integrity living around Loch Ness seeing the water monsters.
How did the monsters first get into Loch Ness, would you say?
I'm often asked this, and it's a very simple story. About 7,500 years ago, which is a very short time in history if you stop to think about it, Loch Ness was an arm of the North Sea. And then it was closed instantaneously by a local land upheaval in the area where the town of Inverness now stands. So it would seem that these animals were coming to and from the sea, using Loch Ness as a feeding or breeding ground maybe, as sea creatures use the Scandinavian fields, and some were trapped.
You reckon they feed on the fish in the loch, is that it?
They have to be fish eaters because there's no vegetation in Loch Ness and the plankton content is low. And the fact that they're fish eaters is maybe why we see them, because 75% of the fish in Loch Ness are within 10 feet of the surface. So these Nessies have to do 75% of their feeding within 10 feet of the surface.
Frank, submarines and divers have been down. No one's ever seen a dead monster. Wouldn't there be skeletons down below?
Yes. On the bottom of the loch in the peat sludge would be the skeletons of everything that's ever died in Loch Ness, because no bodies ever come to the surface. That is an established fact.
Right, now, in your 10 years, how many have you personally sighted?
I've made 31 definite sightings, and I've taken pictures on 8 different occasions.
From the bank here? Or?
Some from the bank and some from the boat. More from the boat, because I have spent 32,000 hours out on Loch Ness in an open boat.
32,000?
Yes.
And how near, what's the nearest you've been to a monster?
This is a problem. The nearest I've been is about 300 metres, which in 22 square miles of water is comparatively close.
And now for another of our Down Your Way characters, Mrs. Ellie Hayworth of Whitworth in Greater Manchester. We went to her house, but earlier I'd seen her at a loom in a cotton mill, and I just didn't understand how she could possibly bear all that noise.
Well, we get used to it, and I like doing the work, because I've always been conscientious, and I like to make good cloth if I can. I believe in doing a job proper, if I can. You understand that, don't you? Also, I believe in helping other people if I can. That's been my motto through life.
Well, it's a marvellous motto, but you can't talk to anybody during the day. What do you think of while you're doing that weaving?
Well, you concentrate your mind on your work.
Hmm.
Try to do it properly, and if you've other problems, well, you put them on one side, don't we, really?
How long have you been weaving for?
I started when I was 12.
Gosh.
And I'm 66 now.
And you've moved from mill to mill?
Yes, yes, with the recessions, you know, how they've been, yes.
Would you have chosen any other career?
No, no, no. Been a happy life.
It's good.
Yes, yes, it has.
Well, now, one of the other things I know you do is you go round and you give recitations, don't you, of Lancashire dialects?
Yes.
Who do you give these to?
Well, the blind and the cripples and the housebound and these old people's homes, you know, been all over Rochdale, Bournemouth, North Wales, Isle of Man.
All over the place. But look, what about giving our listeners a little bit of pleasure? Can you give us a sample of something you do?
Yes, I will. Just a short one. Mm-hmm. Top off, Peg. I were brought up in a terraced house in a narrow dogleg street. There were none on us. I were at last born one rainy night. General Strat were on at time. No gas, no coil, no note. At least that's what my old mam said. I don't remember out. But what I do remember, so does my sister Meg. Without it were a luxury when Dad gimme top or thig. My children, they think I'm codding, and they laugh in disbelief as they tuck into their T-bone steaks, scampi, duckling and roast beef. I tell them how man pawned her clothes at pawn shop or Boundary Road. 18 pence, that's all he geet. Teaser of her lord, who paid what he owed at corner shop, and for rest at week, her'd beg. But all us on a Friday night, Dad gimme top off the egg. I've made a penny or two since then, my children won't go short. 3 meals a day and a cart at school, and back one again they brought. I envy them, and then again I thinks, how much they miss. Like one made toffee, nettle beer, Sundays, spore, and solo whist. Didn't have too much for granted. We sat a tack them down a peg and do like me old dad did. Just gee them. Top off, peg.
In 1979, the Down Your Way team went to Australia and recorded 6 Down Your Ways Down Under. The highlight of our trip was a journey into the dry, arid Northern Territory to visit the green oasis in its middle, the romantically named Alice Springs. The chief ranger of the old telegraph station, Keith Thomas, told us how it all started.
Well, the station here was first set up in 1871. That was the year they discovered the waterhole. There was a survey party coming through here to set up the first telegraph line to cross Australia to set up communications with England. Fortunately, they found a waterhole here, which is not always here, but in that particular year there was a good waterhole here. It was a good site, a good sheltered site with plenty of water, so they decided that this would be the site for a repeater station. Charles Todd was the Postmaster General of South Australia. He was the brains behind this line crossing Australia. So they named the waterhole after his wife, Alice, and they called the river the Todd River after him.
Well, there is the waterhole, absolutely dried up now, and a very dry river, and that's the River Todd, is it?
The Todd, yes. Now, if you'd been here last year, you would have seen a waterhole that was probably 15 or 16 foot deep. Mm. And that's normally after we get a flash flood. But you'll find water, still find water about 2 feet down.
What about the climate? We were told it was going to be the hottest. In fact, it's in the middle 90s today, I gather. What's it get up to here?
Well, I've seen it up to 117 degrees. We've just gone through a period of about 19 days when we've had it over 100 degrees every day for 19 days.
What sort of people are here now, then, resident?
I think the type of people that we got here today, I think, are still the people that have got that pioneering spirit still in them, the people that are willing to get away from the cities, because as you probably realise, about 80% of the population of Australia lives in cities around the seaboard. It's a go-ahead town, it's got a population of 14,000, and it seems to go ahead all the time. People are continually moving in. There's an American space research base here. Mm-hmm. The main industry is the tourist industry.
And what would be the major tourist attraction in Alice?
Well, of the year, I would say Henley on the Todd.
Henley on the Todd, right. The Todd's the river. What's Henley on the Todd?
Well, the Todd is normally a dry river. Mm-hmm. And they decided some years ago that they would have a regatta here, but they never had any water for it. And so they decided that they were going to still have the regatta. And Henley on the Todd is the same as any normal regatta, but except the boats don't have any bottoms in them.
People run inside the
shells. And people run inside the shells. And they have different length races, and they have a surfing event, and they finish up with a naval battle at the end of it. But it's all done in a completely dry riverbed.
I want you to hear something which happened when we were recording Down Your Way in Hay-on-Wye, a small town of 1,200 inhabitants in Powys. Most of you, I hope, listen or have listened from time to time to the programme.
If so, you will know that at the end of each interview, I ask my victim to choose a piece of music. And on this occasion, I just finished talking to Richard Booth, a young, rather eccentric bookseller who had transformed the market town of Hay-on-Wye into a book town, with his 6 second-hand bookshops containing millions of books on all subjects. When I asked him for his choice of music, I happened to catch his eye, and he began to giggle. This was fatal for me, as if anyone starts to giggle, I immediately follow, or corpse, as they say in the business. So I tried to put my question, but each time everyone started to laugh, including my producer Carol Stone and our engineer. I've played this tape once before on the air, and Jimmy Tarbuck told me he was driving along in his car listening to the radio and heard it, and began to laugh so much that he had to pull up at the side of the road. See if it affects you in the same way. Right, Richard, now we want a piece of music. I don't know what your taste is in that direction.
That's it, right.
Right, Richard, now we want a piece of music from you. What's your taste in that direction?
I like... Can I have... Can I have Golden Years or anything by David? Can I have Golden Years or anything by David?
He did get there in the end. After 15 years and more than 4,500 interviews, Brown decided to leave Down Your Way. He was now 75. And when he realised he'd equaled the number of Down Your Ways presented by Franklin Engelman, it seemed a good time to stop. For his 733rd and final programme, Brown chose his beloved Lord's Cricket Ground, and his final interview was with an old friend.
Well, now, to end our programme from Lord's, I'm going to talk to someone who used to sell scorecards here when he wasn't watching the cricket. He used to bowl at the members. He even was on the heavy roller out in the middle. He also happened to make a few thousand runs here and play for Middlesex and England. And you may have guessed it's none other than Dennis Compton. Compers, lovely to see you.
And you, Jonathan. It's great to be on your programme.
Thank you very much. Now, when did you first appear at Lord's? Can you remember?
Yes, I can. Vividly, funnily enough, in 1933 I walked through the nursery gates there onto the fourth class ground staff. We used to sweep the ground, sell match cards, which I didn't sell very many because I was watching the cricket all the time. On a Saturday in a test match, everybody tried to sell 100 dozen copies.
Right.
And you used to get a commission. And so at the end of the day, very tired in fact, you used to work out about 30 bob each, and I really thought I was a millionaire.
Not bad, was it?
Wonderful.
What about the old heavy roller? Do you have to push that?
Had to do that. It took about 15 boys to pull it. Very heavy roller. Yeah. But of course, when you had it then, I mean, it produced marvellous wickets.
Yeah. Weren't you spotted by Sir Pelham Warner, the great plum?
That's right, when I played against the young amateurs for the young professionals.
How old would you have been then?
14, and I opened the innings with Arthur McIntyre.
Yeah.
And that's how my reputation came as a run-out specialist, because I ran old Arthur McIntyre out when he was 25.
You started as you went on then, didn't you?
And I managed to get 100.
Yeah.
And Sir Pelham Warner was watching, and he called my mother and father and said, we'd like this boy to come on our ground staff.
You'll always be associated with your old friend, and I see you've got your tie on, the WJE and DCS tie there, 50 years together.
That's right, 50 years at Lord's.
Bill Everidge.
I miss old Billy. He was a very, very great friend of mine.
I suppose everybody will remember that golden summer of 47.
I know, yes. It never stopped shining, the sun, and, well, it was just one of those things when we both went to the wicket and we knew we were going to make runs.
Mm.
But, you know, I mean, I've had other occasions when I thought, well, where's my next run coming from?
Any special innings you can pick out in test matches here?
Well, I think, strangely enough, I got 76 not out against
1938
against Australia in the second innings, and I don't think I could have played much better than that.
Yeah.
So that was probably one of the great knocks
I
played.
Yes, you actually came to the rescue. We weren't doing so well.
That's quite right, yes. It was very timely, but I enjoyed the 200 I scored against South Africa in the test in 47 here. And I enjoyed a match against Somerset when Bill and I put on 476 runs, I think, in 4 1/4 hours.
Yes, you were always in a bit of a hurry, weren't you?
Well, yes, we like to get on with it a bit, yes.
Just looking up at the pavilion there, do you remember the happy days we used to have to the right there in the Warner stand doing the television?
Oh, yes, I'll never forget those days, Brian. When you and I were operating in the television, and we did have some fun, didn't we?
Lovely to talk to you in this, and thank you for letting me interview my last chap.
And, Jonas, may I say to you, congratulations, old boy. You've always contributed so much to the game, in spite of everything, sport, fun, and congratulations on your 733rd appearance.
Although Brian had retired from Down Your Way, he was still working as hard as ever, with regular broadcasts on radio and television. He was on programmes such as The Generation Game, Noel's House Party, and Jim Will Fix It.
Now, here we go with a letter from Bracknell in Berkshire.
Dear Jim, could you fix it for me to play cricket against David Gower? My dad plays for Warfield, and I want to bowl for England against the West Indies and get 10 wickets. Yours, Russell Doig.
And the great Brian Johnston is the only voice in the world to tell us all about this tremendous confrontation.
Good evening and welcome to this delightful White City ground. Light fading a bit, Dickie Bird will be getting a bit anxious about it, but David Gower batting quite beautifully, the most elegant batsman in the world today, possibly. And young Russell Doig, only 8-year-old, bowling to him. It's a fine bowl there from him. He's got a wonderful action for a small boy. He's only 4'2". Watch this action as he comes up now. He gets a real swivel into his body, and there it goes, a beautiful one on the middle and off, and David can't take any risks. That one just comes forward and plays it beautifully out on the offside. It really is a most marvellous prospect, I think, for England. On the leg side, well, David probably got that through the field, but knowing Russell, he knows where all the fields should be. He's probably got a deep mid wicket, but he's a prospect as a fast bowler. He's only 8. There he is again. Well pitched up.
Nearly a Yorker.
Nearly Yorker, David.
Are you there?
So that was a very good one, straight
now,
and
a
Yorker.
A lot of people say I'm very bad just outside the off stump. So far, it's very good. It's nice and straight.
Yeah.
But let's see, I've got 2 slips there, ready to catch it, like, you know, Malcolm Marshall has the same sort of thing.
David Gower being very sporting and giving him a little tip that perhaps sometimes he doesn't quite move his feet outside the old stump. But that one is on the middle of the leg. And it's a very good line, young Russell's keeping. And he'll become a fine fast bowler if he goes on like this. Well, pitch up, got him a little bit up. The fingers must have been raised then. I don't know.
Nasty moment.
I think David's heart was in his mouth then. Again, Russell, watch that action. And David Gower is bowled by the 8-year-old Russell Doig.
Over the years, Brown was a popular guest on chat shows, where he loved to tell all his stories and jokes. As well as his famous nose, Brown also had rather large ears, which managed to upstage even Frankie Howard when they appeared on Parkinson.
Do you think Brian's got the face for a comedian?
Oh, what? Yes, I do. As a matter of fact, it's not a large image, you're anti. A little bit.
Well, I do. I once met him in the gallery of the Café de Paris, and I showed him my nose, and I said, Mr. Durante, I said, this is bigger than yours. And he said, it's the Moika distinction. It's the Moika distinction. You're a lovely man.
No, but he was.
He was.
I tell you why you have it. First of all, you don't need to be a comedian because you're brilliant at other things.
Thanks very much.
Not at all. You are.
You're very good.
No, but you have, may I say so, you have warmth, which is very important. You obviously have a kind of humility. You have a kind of way of expressing yourself. You have a sense of humour. And you have a sense of humour about yourself, which is very important. I know a lot of comedians who haven't, by the way, haven't got much sense of humour about themselves. You have a great sense of being able to put over something and appeal to people who are watching you. I think you make a face, but I don't want you to be a comedian if you don't mind.
Why don't we do it?
Don't do a double act
one day.
I'd love to.
Add to all that you say about him, he also does an amazing trick with his ears, don't you?
Who told you about
Let's
that?
Let's have a close-up on Mr. Johnson, if you can.
This isn't quite true. I used to be able to tuck both the ears in. I can only now tuck one in.
Which one?
Well, the right one. And I just do like that, you see. And it may be too hot in here, but I think it'll stay in a bit. And you see, it goes like that. I'll do one more.
Michael.
What?
I can honestly say, all my years, and I've never seen a show stolen by an ear.
On Wogan, Brown's fellow guest was Ronnie Corbett.
Do you have a favourite golfing story? I mean, apart from that rather sad one that you just told us.
Well... I've run out of golfings. I've been on here so often.
Well, you always go round with 2 pairs of socks, don't you?
Why is that,
In case you get a hole in one.
Very good, very good.
This man is a spoiled performer, I tell you.
Have we got time for the dog story, Tarby's story?
Go on.
No, it's only of his friend who had the little white poodle. It's an old story, isn't it? And this golfer used to go around the little white poodle. And when he did a good drive, a good putt, the poodle got on his high paws and clapped the front paws.
Yes.
And so Tarby said to this chap, he said, what happens if you miss a putt or get in a bunker? And the chap said, oh, he turns a lot of somersaults. So Jimmy said, how many? And the chap said, depends on how to kick him up the arse.
That Tarbuck doesn't care what he says.
No, he's
shameless. But of course, he works. That's why he works for the other side. You see.
Well,
as indeed, after this, you may well.
Is that the first time that word has been said at this time of evening?
What word?
Bottom word.
Oh, yeah. Botty.
Botty.
The botty word. No, we normally don't go further than botty.
No, right.
So we shall, because this is not live, we'll cut that out later. You do have a song with which you bore your family regularly, don't you?
Well, I don't bore the family, but sometimes I go to leaving dinners, instead of making a pompous speech, how glad I am to have known the people, I sing a little song, and it goes something like this. Columbus discovered America. Hudson discovered New York. Benjamin Franklin discovered the spark, which Edison discovered would light up the dark. But Marconi discovered the wireless telegraph across the ocean blue. But the greatest discovery was when you discovered me, and I discovered you can't do without you, when I discovered you.
But of course, Brown will always be remembered for his 48 years on television and radio as a cricket commentator.
And it's good morning to Brian Johnston.
Good morning to you, Coz. Good morning, Boyle.
Good morning, Brian.
Good morning, Birdie Wonder. And good morning, everybody. And it is a fine day. It's clouded over a little bit, but I'm told that it won't rain today.
I had no idea I would do cricket when I joined the BBC as an odd jobs man. But I've always been lucky. And in April 1946, Ian Orr Ewing, who had played a lot of cricket with me, was then head of television outside broadcast. He rang me to say they were restarting cricket on television and would I like to have a shot at being a commentator. I leapt at the chance, and it was great fun learning and helping to shape the art of television commentary, which I did until 1970. Since then, I've done the Radio 3 ball-by-ball test match special. I've had many highlights, but perhaps the two outstanding were the only occasions when England won back the Ashes in the last 50 years. In 1953, I was lucky enough to be the commentator on television when Len Hutton's team won the fifth test and the Ashes at the Oval. On the last day, the Middlesex twins, Edrich and Compton, were together, and this is how the Ashes came back to England after 19 years, Dennis Compton sweeping the winning four.
Four runs needed. Now, will this be got in one stroke? No, brilliantly fielded by Davidson. Two balls to go this over from Morris. Four runs to get. No, is it? Is it the Ashes? Yes, England have won the Ashes.
A thrilling and emotional moment, but no more so than at Sydney in 1971, when after a close and controversial match, Ray Illingworth's side, already one up in the series, won the last test. Radio 2 stayed open all night to get the result. And once again, I was the lucky one on the air at the time of victory.
So Jenner goes to four, that's nine for 160. So that is 63 runs. 63 runs still needed, one wicket to fall. Underwood bowling, this time to Jenner, still with these two men very close in on the other side, bowls this one, and Jenner goes to sweep that one, is going up in the air, but he goes off his pad, and excitement from the crowd has knocked dashes for it, but this went off his pad as he tried the sweep which has cost so many wickets in this match, people being caught off the top edge, bowl round behind the legs, and so on. In comes Underwood again now, bowls to Jenner, bowls this very wide the crease, a quicker one, and he goes off bat and pad, he's caught! He's out caught, Underwood has got the wicket. He was caught there by Fletcher at Philly Point, and England have won the Ashes. England have won the Ashes back after 12 years, and Illingworth is being cheered off by his team.
A great moment. I suppose the most extraordinary match on which I have commentated was the semi-final of the Gillette Cup at Old Trafford in 1971 between Lancashire and Gloucestershire. It went on in front of 30,000 people until 10 to 9 in more or less total darkness, with the lights in the pavilion and the Warwick Road station shining brightly across the ground. This is how I described the finish to radio listeners after David Hughes had struck 24 and one over off poor John Mortimer to make the scores level.
Proctor coming in. I could just see him emerging from the gloom at the far end, bowling to Jackie Bond. He bowls his knee, hits it up to mid-on. They won't run, though, Davy feels. And all the small boys are ready to run on. They've been running on in the excitement, I'm afraid, just now when that six was hit. They've stopped one or two fielders from stopping fours. Tremendous excitement. They're waiting round the ropes now. Lancashire needing one run to win. And listen to this. Yes, this is a cricket match. It's cricket. You wouldn't think it in this light. You could hardly recognise. Luckily, they're wearing white flannels. One can see them in the dark. Two more balls, it's over. And after that, there will be three overs to go. So Lancashire have only need one run. They've got three wickets in hand. And, of course, they will basically get it. They must. But tremendous excitement there. People waiting. The hands of the clock at 5 to 9 over the pavilion. It's completely dark, really, now. Quite impossible for cricket, really. Here's Proctor bowling to Bond, and he hits this one, and it's gone through for one run on the offside. Lancashire are in the final. Lancashire won.
Cricket to me has always been fun, and all of us in the radio commentary box enjoy our cricket and are a very happy team. I hope some of this friendly atmosphere comes over the air. I have to plead guilty to perpetrating a lot of gaffes. Many of them are famous by now, but I assure you I don't do them on purpose.
It's going to be snow to the crouching Henry Horton, who looks as if he's sitting on a shooting stick without the shooting stick, if you see it. I mean, he crouches very low indeed with his posterior sticking out.
That's Harvey at leg slip there, with his legs wide apart, hoping for a tickle.
I beg your pardon. You mean a catch?
There's always something funny going on out in the field. What about it, Headingley? One of the funniest incidents I've ever had to describe.
Up comes Hilda now. Bills this one outside the off-stump. And that's steered away on the offside. And a nice bit of fielding by Julian there. And there might be overthrows. Here there are. He throws back. So they've taken two already. One of them an overthrow. And they're taking the second overthrow. So 3 runs to 0 from ball. He's steered from outside the off-stump. And there are going to be more. And there are going to be another 4. This is going to be quite sensational. 4 overthrows added to that. So Knott has got 7. And they're trying to work which end they've got to go.
Spencer signalled 6.
Now, Spencer signalled 6 then, which is extraordinary, but they've got to work out which end to go. Not, you should be the other end if they've run 7, chap. That's right. You go up there, they're arguing like mad. They're both coming to the same end, but it must be right for Knott to go to the other end.
Plus 2 plus 4.
And both the umpires are consulting now. This is the best model. This is marvellous. Oh, it's lovely. Knott doesn't know which end to come. I could tell him he should be at the other end, and they're leaving him at this end. But if he's called 7... Look, and Constant is talking to Knott, and one short is there, but that doesn't make a difference. That doesn't make a difference which end they go.
No, it doesn't.
This is absolutely. And Knott's going down the other end now, and Spencer's talking to Greg. This is absolutely splendid, isn't it? Both the umpires consulting, the two batsmen are there, everybody's in a state of flummox. Lloyd's going in on the act, but it must be, if it's 7 runs, right. Knott must be at the other end.
Even if it's 6 and 1 short, he's.
And we've got to work out if it is 1 short, but these all these signals. And now he's signalling byes. Now that can't be. 2 short is he signalling? And now Lloyd is putting up 6.
He's signalling 5 plus 2, I think, now, as his way of signalling 7.
Well, anyhow, Knott has gone to 41 on the board, so they've given him 9, haven't they? Oh, no, he was 34, that's right, they've given him 7, 269.
That was 7 runs.
That was absolutely splendid. Yeah. One of the best things I've seen in Test cricket.
We'll have more cricket later, but first, a letter from a listener.
Just going to quickie in, has the umpire come out?
Yep.
Can you please explain why in the game of cricket an appeals procedure is necessary or justifiable? This comes from...
it's not the Prime Minister William Pitt, but this is William H. Titt, and he said, can you...
The umpires are coming out.
Here they come, John. As you move over, I'll do some commentating. Trevor's come to join me.
A cup of tea.
And the situation, the England side coming out into the field, it wasn't a very successful session in the last one, just one wicket, bowling defensively into the rough.
You dropped your letter, Brownie.
But England are in a lot of trouble now.
No one was more surprised than Brown when a year after joining the BBC, he became one of the regular team of commentators for the annual Oxford and Cambridge boat race. He knew almost nothing about rowing, although his father had been an Oxford Blue and rowed in the boat race twice. For his first year, Brown was stationed on a small floating platform alongside Hammersmith Bridge, and as usual, the race commentator was John Snagg.
Well now, as we're coming up to Hammersmith, Brian Johnson is there waiting for us. Says he's they come towards him. Let's go over to Brian Johnson and see what he thinks as they shoot Hammersmith Bridge. Over to Brian Johnson.
Well, here they come towards me now, and Oxford are certainly an easier length in front, and they seem to be going the same rate of strokes here, and the crowd have spotted them and are really cheering at the top of their voice. You can probably hear them. And I should say now that Oxford are trying to put on the pace a little bit. They're both over on the Surrey side. Oxford aren't right over on their station. They're going to come about immediately under the middle of the bridge, I should think, and they should clear it before Cambridge, so we shall hear them go under and then Cambridge. And they're easily a length, I think a length, perhaps and a quarter, as they're coming towards now about 50 yards away from the bridge, and they're rowing very steadily. Cambridge are more or less behind them. Oxford have come across in front of Cambridge, and they'll be going straight under the lamppost about 50 yards away from me. Oxford are going to shoot Hammersmith Bridge. Now, listen. Oxford are a length and three quarter, length and a half, length three quarters ahead, and our launches are going underneath the bridge now, and so I hand you back to John Snagg on The Magician.
After the BBC launch broke down in 1949 and John Snagg couldn't see who'd won, Brown was moved to the finishing line near Chiswick Bridge, from where he was to broadcast for the next 25 years. But in 1978, he was on board the launch Ursula when conditions suddenly took a turn for the worse.
Well, we're not in very slack water, though. We're on the Middlesex side. We're level with Cambridge at the moment, but it's very rough here. The spray's coming right into old Ursula. She's getting a bit wet, and the other launches are just behind us to near our side there, but we're level with Cambridge. They're just about 30 yards away to our left there, and we're doing very well. Ursula's doing well against Cambridge, but Oxford are drawing away there, but they look as if they're going through very rough water. Tom, I reckon the time now won't be as good as it was up at Hammersmith.
Cambridge are sinking. Cambridge are going down right where they sank in 1859.
Tremendous rescue operation. One of the Cambridge crew has been lifted out of the bows. The others are right under the water. They've just seen their shoulders, one or two of them, swimming now towards the launch, which are taking them on board. Their boat, you can still see on the surface. The captain is leaving last, more or less. That means stroke is still there. About six of them are now being taken aboard. They must be jolly cold and wet. And I think that the boat is all on its side now. It must be going under very nearly, rather like the oil tanker. And Oxford, I think, are just about to go to the winning post. So over to you, Tom Boswell.
4 years later, John Snagg retired, and Brown took over as the main boat race commentator for the first time.
Two crews are just waiting. And crowd, huge crowds here on the bridge just behind us, all waiting for this moment. The flag is up, and we're waiting for it to come down, and then it'll be the start of the 120th boat race, and they're off. And it's Cambridge from this side here, just perhaps getting off to a bit of start. They look much neater perhaps than Oxford. Oxford are a very heavy, much heavier crew, and we'll give the time and their striking rate off the first minute. At the moment we're whizzing along on the right flank here on the Middlesex side. They look pretty level at the moment. They're going right along the ball on our left, right, the Fulham ball, and both crews going at a good striking rate, and we've got to keep at a pretty good pace to keep up with them. But it's hardly any difference between the two crews.
Brown's 42nd and last boat race was in 1989, and it turned out to be a closely fought contest.
Cambridge again won. No quarter between these two ladies. You can see there's tremendous rivalry between the coxes, and Cambridge still being warned. It's
So Oxford now, just, I suppose, a fraction behind. It's difficult just to see the...
Oxford!
And Oxford
being warned as well.
In other words, you can see that there's a tremendous clash of balls there. They're very close together. And
now they're both being warned.
Yes, and Ronnie Howard now got the flag up, essentially warning them both.
Cambridge
being warned. These girls are giving nothing at all. They're just going straight on, and they don't seem to be shifting when the umpire tells them.
Oxford won. And back at the boathouse, Brown was greeted on the towpath by the Duke of Edinburgh, who presented both him and Tom Sutton with a special book to commemorate all their years with the boat race.
What a wonderful surprise, with the Fantastic. Duke giving it. Yeah. You know, I haven't seen him for a long time. It was very nice of him. And I asked him if he ever rode in a thing like this. He said, no, only in the Navy. But, you know, he was looking very well. But it was a marvellous honour. And thanks to the BBC, I think he's absolutely splendid.
But Tom, for you, 30 years, and John is for you, 40 years. I mean, that's not true. You can't be giving it up.
Well, yeah, the young boys must come along, you know. And I think it's their turn. We've had a most wonderful time. And Oxford won the last time for me, which is nice.
The best moment for you over the years?
I think it must be the one, the tearjerker, really, of 1987, when Oxford, after all that, well, we call it mutiny, which is a nasty word, but when all that fuss, and they got a scratch team, I mustn't say team, a scratch crew together in about 6 weeks' time, you know, and then they won the boat race. I think, and to see MacDonald, the president, standing up under the bridge, I thought that was a tremendous moment. Great. I was blubbing.
It
does happen.
Another sport from Brown's early days at the BBC was show jumping. In 1948, he was at the White City for the International Horse Show and described the exciting final round of the King George V Cup, when all British hopes rested on Fox Hunter, ridden by Colonel Harry Llewellyn.
And he's off, and now this first jump, and he's cleared the four logs, he's cleared them now into these double poles, and he's over the first one, and he's over the other parallel ones, but one awful moment I thought exactly he's going to just catch the top one, but no, here he comes, a nice, very slow, collected canter, looking supremely calm and confident. That's why one likes to look at Fox Hunter so much. And now he's going away from us into the triple bush, and he clears it. Now there's this awful brick wall. Oh, and he's misplaced one there. That's four faults. Remember, the other two have had eight faults, so he's still in the lead, but he mustn't knock anything else over, or you'll be level with them. What a pity that. He just knocked off a brick in the middle, and he's coming towards the railway sleepers. Yes, he cleared them all right. And now these three, first of all the gate, he takes it much faster than the last person, over the reverse oxer, and over the third gate. I thought he was going to gibbet it for a second, but no. And he rounds the corner over this wall with the rail, and he's cleared that, and now he's got three jumps to go, and he's in the lead with only four faults. And he's cleared the first one, and now there's this double oxer, rather fighting for his head, but he clears it all right, and now for the parallel bars, and he's in the lead. And that's really a terrific moment for Great Britain here, as Fox Hunter wins the King George V Challenge Cup with a round in which he only had four faults against the eight of the other three competitors.
In 1952, Brown went at the last moment as co-driver and co-broadcaster on the Monte Carlo Rally with Richard Dimbleby. In spite of the fact they arrived a day late, Brown was to report on the rally for radio for the next 6 years. And he provided the commentary for this special episode of Hancock's Half Hour.
This is Brown Johnson reporting once again on the progress made so far in the Monte Carlo Rally. Now, we've just heard that the first driver to reach Dover was Captain Anthony Wheels Hancock in his 1896 modified AJY Special.
Pray silence, please, worship the Lord.
Congratulations, Captain Hancock, on breaking a record for the Glasgow to Dover run. What a fantastic speed you must have kept up.
Ah, well, it's downhill all the way, isn't it?
Downhill? It's not, you know.
Well, it is for us. We've got big back wheels.
Good evening, listeners. Brown Johnston again, and here is the latest news of the Monte Carlo Rally. The halfway stage has been reached, and I'm very pleased to say that so far the British contingent has kept fairly well together. But the most amazing thing is that leading the field is none other than Wheels Hancock. Yes, that 59-year-old car of his is holding its own against the high-powered, up-to-date sports model from all over the world. They just can't seem to pass him. I'd give anything to know just how he's managing to do it.
All right, Sid, we've crossed the bridge.
Right, blow it up.
Brian with Tony Hancock, Sid James and Kenneth Williams. His locations weren't always as glamorous as Monte Carlo. To celebrate the 60th anniversary of Louis Blériot's flight across the Channel, a transatlantic air race was organised in 1969. Brown was in a coal yard in London to describe how one competitor was hoping to beat the record.
Just at the moment as the Wessex helicopter has dropped Squadron Leader Lecky Thompson here in the disused coal site at St Pancras. He's waiting to get in now to the vertical takeoff Harrier, which looks there like a giant grasshopper as he goes up now. The helicopter's come in, he's gone across on a motorcycle, he's getting into the cockpit now, and he'll be taking off 200 feet straight up in the into the air. This is unique aviation history being made, the first time a jet fighter has ever taken off from a centre of a city. And there it is there, waiting with its refueling probe sticking out, the underwing fuel tanks, it's dressed as for combat. He'll be going off north and then joining up with his fuel tankers over Bristol. This wonderful jump jet, it'll be a tremendous blast off. Everything will be blowing up here, all the old coal all around the place. They're just strapping him in the cockpit now. The two men in white overalls are up on the ladders on the side, and there was a tremendous noise as this helicopter came in. He'd come down from the tower, clocked in at the top of the tower, gone to the little helipad, come across in the helicopter, and then to keep to the rules, as they'd entered the fact that they were going to go on a motorcycle, they went about 100 yards across this yard in the motorcycle, and then waiting to take off. And it's going to go straight off over the Atlantic. It'll be refueling several times. We're not allowed to know how many times. It can go 600 miles an hour, and it'll be aiming to break every record it can. It comes from number one Squadron Wittering in Stamford. Squadron Leader Lecky Thompson, I spoke to today, is confident he'll do well, and he's got his helmet on, and any moment now we should see the canopy close down on him. In fact, now, the canopy's down, and just stand by for all sorts of things, noises and everything off. It's going to take off in a moment. It'll be going at 300 miles an hour in 20 seconds. It's going up to 37,000 feet, and the engine fired. He put the thumbs up. This is a Pegasus engine, tremendous thrust, 20,000 pounds worth of thrust, and we're all going to stand back here. It's going up in a minute. Everything will be flying here, and I'm going to take protection behind the car. You can probably hear it, the engine in the background now. The engine's going like mad. It's going up in a second. I'll let you know when the wheels leave the ground. Listen to that whine. Squadron Leader Lecky Thompson, I can see him inside the canopy there. The first time ever a jet fighter has left the centre of a city is going to happen. Just watching the wheels, they're not quite off the pad yet. The sharp nose sticking out in front and the fuel probe on the side, the sloping wings down. The vertical takeoff Harrier is just about to go. Stand by for blast off. This looks like being it. Tremendous noise, yes. Yes, he's off. The wheels just left the ground then, but he's still there. Still on the ground. The wheels just left for a moment. And now he's off. Now he's definitely on. He's up in the air. He's going to take off. It's like being in a sandstorm, only it's a cold storm instead. I shall be completely black. I'm in a white suit like a silly art. And he's going off now. He's disappearing out of sight. He's already going at 300 miles an hour, going off, and then he'll turn left, going to Bristol to rejoin the tankers there, and then he'll be going out across the Atlantic, and we hope beating the records. The first time ever a vertical takeoff Harrier has ever taken off from the centre of the city anywhere in the world.
The first London Marathon was in 1981. And Brown was at Tower Bridge to see the leading runners come across.
Two police outriders lead a television van. They've come onto the bridge and are just going over it. There's a flashing light coming from the south side. Remember, they're coming slightly up gradient from Jamaica Road, and they must be just coming into the bridge. All activity here, the spectators lining either side of the Tower Bridge, and this is the moment they've been waiting for, the first view of the runners. Remember, they will have been 13 miles, and we'll try and spot the, I've got John Taylor being race reader for me, and we'll try and spot the leading numbers. Yes, here's a van packed with people, a yellow lorry, and there's one just going by there. It looks like a band. It must be the band playing there. And another television camera. So the runners can't be far behind. The people cheering now. We can see one or two people waving, two more policemen on motor bicycles.
And here come the leading runners under the archway now, just running past us now. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven. A group of seven, and then a gap of about 50 yards, and then two more runners behind them. John Taylor's just confirmed to me that it's Dick Beardsley from Boston, United States, and he's definitely in the lead. And we think it was number 20 in Simonson from Norway who was second, but just that little group in front. And Dick Beardsley, in fact, has never won a major marathon, but he's Chris Brasher's favorite, and at the moment he seemed to be going very well. And just to show you how far ahead that group is, no one else has come since I stopped saying that those were the first eight runners, I think it was. A little group of seven and then two. So it must be nine runners, a little group, long way ahead. I can't see any other runners coming at the moment at all. So there's a big blank, and I think there may be someone coming across the bridge now. Yes, here's another one going across. I only hope they don't open those twin bascules. Remember once a bus was going up and they opened the thing and the chap had to jump in the bus. So we don't want that to happen, but luckily they've kept it down and they've crossed the middle. It's a single runner coming. He's going pretty well. He's all by himself, so they've really spread out, which is really remarkable.
But Brown's main sport was always cricket, and thousands of blind listeners enjoyed his commentaries on Test Match Special. He was a keen supporter of blind cricket, and for the In Touch programme, tried to explain the rules.
You are joining me now at a game of cricket for the blind. It's in the middle of a playing field on a glorious morning. And basically what happens is this. It's an 18-yard pitch. The stumps are 35 inches high. The ball is the size of a football, size 5, and it has 150 ball bearings in it. The bowler must bowl two bounces to someone who is totally blind, or one bounce before it reaches the crease to someone who is partially blinded. And a blind person can get away with one LBW or one hit wicket. And if a catch goes to someone who is totally blind, it can bounce once. Otherwise, the partially blind have to take it on the full. And I just watched this now. Someone is going to run up to bowl. 18 yards, remember, is the length of the pitch. And there's a boy there in glasses bowling that over on me. There's a young girl playing left-handed. She can't reach it, so that was a wide. It would be a no ball if it's a full pitch. But that one was a wide. She couldn't possibly reach it. So it's incredible, really. You try playing cricket with your eyes shut. Even though the ball, you can hear it coming with these 150 ball bearings. It's very difficult. We just take one more ball coming down now. It bounced three times, and the girl has hit it. Well done. She went right across there and played it. She'll play for England one day, I'm absolutely sure.
From the late 50s, Brown travelled whenever he could to watch England play abroad, especially when it was Australia. After the victorious Ashes tour of 1971, he wrote the lyrics for a team song and put it to an old music hall tune, Show Me Your Winkle Tonight. On the flight home with the England team, the song had its first performance.
As we were coming home, we came back from New York on that way round, and as we crossed over the English coast, coming back to Blighty, so to speak, as we were over Land's End, we sang it to all the rest of the passengers in the plane. I stood up, and they always laugh when I conduct, but we got through the song all right, and it was rather the amazement of the Americans. But it's a jolly little tune, and we hope the words will catch on. It's all about what happened on the tour, you know. I'll just sing you the first verse. We've brought the ashes back home, we've got them here in the urn. The Aussies had had them 12 years, so it was about our turn. Oh, what a tough fight it was in the dazzling sunlight, and in spite of the boos of the mob on the hill, we won by 2-0. Boom, boom. And then we go on and on and on like that, you see.
We brought the ashes back home.
The record was not a hit. But in the commentary box, Brown was completely at home, whether it was telling a new joke, reading out a listener's letter, talking about neighbours, or trying some chocolate cake. Always with a smile in his voice and in his own inimitable style.
Well, Willis is the ground level. He's running up the hill now, and he's coming in to bowl to Edgar. And he's bowled him! Cleaners, absolutely, middle stump knocked out. Edgar out for 84, bowled by Willis.
Takes the score up to 34. He's coming in again now to bowl to Haynes. And Haynes is hit on the pad. That must be LBW. He's got an LBW. It looked absolutely plumbers. And Haynes is LBW, bowl Willis for 8.
Logie comes in from square leg and hits the stumps, and he's gone off, and Arthurton backing up well, so he can't get an overthrow, and David Shepherd then does his little ballet signal. He waggles his left foot in the air, and that's another leg by. Trombone time, 76 for three. I'm joined by the balls, by the Boyle, sitting alongside me. Welcome back, Boyle.
Thank you very much.
As Hadley comes up now, Burles has one well pitched up outside the off stump and hit away to Edgar at cover, and there's no run.
So, as the umpires, who are Dickie Bird and Barry Mayer, come to the middle, and that massive erection at the city end of the ground comes into view, I will leave Brian Johnston to describe that and other matters to you.
Good morning, everybody in the West Indies. Good morning, everybody in Great Britain, anywhere else who may be listening. With the news that that inflatable erection has now become deflated, and it's had something to do with nuts. I don't know about it, but it has now sunk to the ground, exhausted. They've undoubtedly taken off the fire or whatever lights a balloon. It looked like a giant top hat on top of a yellow body, but it's now resting down behind the stand there, and obviously was going to put off the players. 104 for two. He's taken the lead up now to 191.
Are you sure?
Yeah, more or less. 87 and four. Yeah, that's right. 191. That's
well,
a good lead.
Well done. I mean, how much money did they spend on your education to get you to that height of taking all that time at 87 and 4?
I don't use computers and all that. It comes out of my head. Well, most of the modern people, the bearded one does.
That's right, Bill. Factory should, yeah.
You ask the bearded one to add 37, 38 together, he won't without pushing his fingers down on those things. I can tell you straight away that it's 77. Just looking at the board.
It's 75.
It's well, it's very near, 75. 37 to a lamb.
It's quietness here, ladies and gentlemen. I shall have left the box.
38 to Hathen. Loud cheers, because we have a streaker. I'm afraid a female lady streaker.
Oh, I prefer them that
and
way.
She's got some shorts on, luckily, but she's coming on, and she's waving a flag. I don't know what it says. She's dancing up and down on the pitch, and she hasn't got much on up above the briefs she is wearing. And Gavaskar, the master, comes down to have a closer look. And he's approaching her now, and he's asking her to get off the pitch, please. And he's prodding down where she's been stepping in her high-heeled shoes. Actually, they aren't high-heeled shoes. And she's dancing about there. It's rather like a bullfight. She's holding this flag in front of him. He's directing her off, and she waves it aloft and other things as well. The England player's pretending not to have a look, but it's amazing how their eyes seem to be wandering in her direction. And some stewards are coming to collect her. And how do you collect a blonde streaker?
She looks nice, doesn't she?
She looks very nice. And the steward is taking her off. She's going back between these two policemen quite happily, but it has rather disturbed the game. And that's the first lady streaker we've had at Lord's. We had the other one in 1975 who did the splits over the stumps. And she's even doing a curtsy. Well, it's one of the most exciting things, I suppose, that have happened today, but not entirely to do with cricket. Fred, you'll be interested. A chap called David Taylor from Sunderland has sent me a definition of the word mosey, which I think, knowing the Alderman, you'll be interested to hear.
Yes, I would.
The word is not in the dictionaries, but is in frequent use in the Midland Counties to express the condition of a turnip when the interior has become dry and fibrous, or of an apple when it is withered and juiceless. It is equivalent to the term woolly, which is used in a similar sense in the southern counties. Well, the alderman now knows why he was called Mosey.
Trust you to find that.
No, you know, David Taylor sent me. Thank you, David. And the alderman's blushing. And here's Marshall running in now to bowl to Athy. Silly point in the short leg, and he pushes out square on the offside again. He won't get a run as he goes to Benjamin coming in from cover. But there we are. I don't know about a turnip. And dry and fibrous. I suppose
withered and juiceless.
Oh, no, you can't. It's not
you
right.
You can't say that about...
of the Alderman, can you?
Not saying that about Miles Noel.
No, no. It's unfair. I take it all back, but thanks for sending it just the same.
He's going to have it framed, Mr. Taylor.
Oh, bit of bad news. Nick in Neighbours has sprained his ankle falling off his skateboard. Oh, dear. Well, these things do happen. Yes, Bearded?
How many people in the cast of Neighbours, roughly?
Oh, 12 active ones.
one down, 11 to go, then.
You'll be all right. You'll be all right, old Nick. But he couldn't go in the race, haven't he? And Matt took his place. And I haven't heard whether he won, but...
Do you really watch that programme, BJ?
Every time. And a friend of mine overlooking Green Park is putting down every single one on video for me when I get back. Here is this one now, outside the Ostend, played off the back foot firmly, but they won't get a run there as he goes for a barker mid-on. But there have been a lot of events going there, and Jim's tree was cut down. That was the trouble.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, a lot of people do listen to it. It's a very serious programme.
Do you watch Coronation Street as well?
No, I only watch Neighbours, but... But when one's at a test match, one can't do it, and I'm delighted to be at the test, but I like a report day by day.
Tony Kozier leaves the box, and this absolutely takes the cake, because he said he wasn't going to give me any of his cake, and he's promptly taken the last piece of mine, and he's munching it as he goes out the box. Well, sorry to see the last of you, Tony.
Yeah.
The munch and interval. So thank you to the National Style Centre for also giving us a very nice, looks like a lemon cake or something, very kind of them, and I hope I can return some of it for you at tea time, because I expect you'll be hungry by then. Well, we did quite well. I had a nice picnic out on the playing field, and just two acknowledgements. Someone presented me with Julie's infamous cake, a lovely chocolate cake which looked like a landmine, but I'm sure it'll taste much better than that. And also the Punters magazine on Radio 4 came and interviewed one or two of us today, and they gave us a delicious chocolate cake too, so Ollie's certain now being able to have a good tea. Lamb plays up one with a bat angle this time, and he hit it off the meat, and it goes all along the ground to Arthton, who's a fine fielder, left-handed, and feels that a cover, no run. And Ollie, what do you think of that last stroke?
Very good shot. I enjoyed. I mean, Alan Lamb takes the... You're just trying to do me here because I've got a mouthful of cake.
Yeah, you have. You're spitting it all into the microphone, too. Really, Ollie. In the middle of an over, you can't resist the cream puffs.
Would you like to ask Brian Johnson a question? He's just popped a sweet in his mouth. He might catch it.
I can talk with it because Headingley would never be the same without our famous Harrogate toffee, which Rosemary Bolland's very kindly sent us again. Every year she sends us this Harrogate toffee. Every year someone gets caught with one in their mouth. Now I've caught one now. A streaker has arrived. A very, very obvious streaker. And he's running on. He is holding some sort of hat in his hand. He's got socks and shoes on. And I don't know what he's going to do when he gets the stumps. Nothing. He's talking to Jack Russell. He's got his gloves on. The umpires don't quite know what to do. And he's going to trot off again, making a dignified trot past the square leg umpire. You might call that a cheeky performance. He's just... don't think he's been sunbathing much. He's been a bit lighter down the backside, perhaps, than the rest of his body. And he trots off. And I don't know if there are any policemen or stewards to meet him. And he risks, he climbed over the board, and it was harder than he thought, and it was a little bit painful for him, I think. You heard the ooh from the crowd. Anyhow, and a booze, as he's obviously been taken away, perhaps for the policeman hiding things with his helmet. Anyhow, let's get on with the game. And the crowd are doing this business. They all stand up, one after the other. So it goes round the ground. They're all standing up, and they hold their hands up, and it goes right round the ground, starting at one corner, going right round. And Blurs is doing it in front of us. I haven't seen it. It evidently happens in the World Cup, but it's a most extraordinary sight. And I'm afraid he may have put off Ezra Din when he was out. And they're all standing up on top of the cricket shed. And it's coming all round the ground. Everybody stands up, holds their arms ahead, and it's Lever coming in as they're doing it, and he bells this one outside the off stump, and Pandit just pushes it forward, and there's no run. But it's amazing the unison they do it. Each row takes over from the others, it goes round the ground. And everybody enjoys it very much, and I must say it looks very funny. Now, I don't know who starts it. Oh, they're doing it again, oh dear. And there, I must just interrupt that the television have caught the parrot, which Peter Baxter took over to be placed on Lamb's shoulder to go with his crush. And the parrot is perched away there, and the television have caught Peter Baxter presenting it.
It isn't. They've come on to us now. They've turned to me and the parrot's on my shoulder. I may tell you, we have one or two parrots. They didn't fly across and fly back. But Lammy was very pleased with his parrot. And you can see the fine features there, Fred Truman on the television set.
I'm Brown Johnson.
And I hope you're only just looking at them and listening to us. Right, well, that's the first person, and we've got two more prizes to come, and more parrots, no doubt. The parrot is making the draw this time.
Oh, what have I got here? That's right, I'll read it out. This is the parrot speaking. It's Jonathan Pendlebury, 62 Victory Road, Little Lever, Bolton, Lancashire, GL31HY, pretty boy, nice boy, 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 boy. Oh, that's the way to do it.
The ball runs up again. Bells. Outside the on-stump, a nice looking stroke played square on the outside, and he's going up towards the square point boundary, but he won't reach there. It's just by the way, and it's fielded by Haynes, who stopped it there, and they take three runs. A square drive by Russell, played a little bit late, but all on the ground, and he gets three good runs there.
Court's got up 250.
And the 251 is on the board, hence the chairs from the crowd. That's the score you wanted to see, Fred. They heard you say it.
103 off that ball.
It's gone to 350 now. It's going to four. Any advance on four? Yes, any advance on five? Any advance on six? It's 651. 751. 800. It's like these fireworks which come down. 951. The West it's only 51 now.
The West Indies have capitulated. They've left the field.
51 for five on the board. As Walsh comes up and falls to Rampercat, who turns his hobby's legs. He might get a run there, goes a bit wide, but they don't run. It's now, as it should be, 151 for five.
One of the things Brown enjoyed most on Test Match Special was the 20-minute interview spot every Saturday lunchtime. Called A View from the Boundary, it was a chance to talk to all kinds of personalities about themselves and cricket. Someone who Brown had always wanted to meet was John Cleese.
I remember quite distinctly in Form 2A in Mr. Sanger Davis's English lesson. it was that particular moment when I started making jokes.
Right.
And I remember that the class laughed, and I remember that made me feel very good, because it is it's actually wonderful feeling to make people laugh. Everybody likes to tell
I've tried for years. I haven't had the feeling yet, but I often wonder too, in those marvellous dashes you made up the stairs in Fawlty Towers, I mean, do you ever trip up going up?
An odd way, although I don't have any rhythm, I'm reasonably coordinated and nimble. I mean, I was always quite good at ball games, just provided they didn't require any physical courage.
But you suddenly turn around and race up those stairs, and most people would trip up or something, but you didn't.
No, I could do that. I mean, everybody thought that was very funny, that way I used to walk or run when I was Basil, but that unfortunately is the way that I walk. It's not a characterisation.
I mean, when you struck poor Manuel, was that a false sort of clap, or did you actually strike him once or twice?
Well, there are ways of doing it that fake it, but on one occasion, I'm afraid, when I was hitting him with a saucepan, I didn't get the timing quite right. And dear old Andrew was kind of a little out to lunch for about 2 days.
Yeah. I think you did 12, is that right?
That's right, only 12.
Any one particular one? I mean, the one with the rat under the...
The rat I was enormously fond of.
Oh, I thought
the rat. They made the special effects department, when they produced that rat... I almost kissed them. I mean, we got about 60 seconds out of that rat sitting in the biscuit tin.
When the chap took the dead body.
And there's my favourite moment is in the one when he goes down to get the duck from the restaurant. You remember, he drops the first one, gets the second, he's only got the blancmange. And when he takes the lid off, my favourite moment is he puts the lid back on as though it might help the blancmange to go away. But when he looks it up, he actually looks in the blancmange. You know, he puts his fingers down just in case there's a duck underneath. That's always the moment that gets me.
Before becoming Prime Minister, John Major was Chancellor of the Exchequer, and in the summer of 1990 still had time to be a regular visitor to the Test Match Special commentary box.
I'm just wondering, when you have all these conferences, and are you ever brought in notes for the latest score?
Certainly in the period I was Chief Secretary, and we had great negotiations with colleagues about spending matters in September, the meetings did used to break up for critical parts of the Test Match to watch it. My then secretary at the time, who was a Surrey member and a fanatical cricketer, used to send in notes to say the Test Match has reached a critical stage, and we did used to break and watch it. And during that period as well, Nigel Lawson is also a great cricket supporter.
Where is he?
A great Leicestershire fan.
Yes.
And we used to sit there with Nigel in the chair, his fellow ministers, lots of extremely important mandarins and others at the other side of the table. And a piece of paper would come in that would be passed gravely around the table. And it was the test score. It wasn't the markets, I promise you.
Do you just nod and also imagine it was some very important financial
It was over the last couple of years. Some of it was very grave. That's certainly true.
In June 1992, Brown was to be 80 years old. And to mark the occasion, Test Match special producer Peter Baxter decided to give him a surprise. Brown thought he was going to interview Ned Sherin and was amazed when the studio announcer handed back after the news, not to Brown, but to Ned.
We're turning the tables on you today, Brown. This today, this is your boundary.
What are you doing to me?
You're being interviewed. I am not.
I don't believe this.
Absolutely true. Aren't you going to be 80 on Wednesday? Haven't we been hearing about that all week?
That's right. I was going to ask you a few questions.
How do I fill up half an hour talking to you? Because you've done 46 years. Have you ever counted up the number of hours that you've rambled on up here?
Rambles ago. Yeah, because I didn't ramble quite so many words, of course, in the first 24 years, because I did the telly, you see, and one was then meant only to speak when you could add to the picture, which, if you watch very closely, you needn't speak at all, really. That was our first thing we were told about television commentary.
The early hero was Patsy Hendren, wasn't it?
Patsy, I became a hero of his when my brother threw me a cricket bat when I was age 7 and said, "You're Patsy Hendren, I'm Jack Hearn." And I worshipped him from that moment, and I used to get the Times before my father could get in, put it on the floor and look at all the cricket scores. And so he had a great effect on me. He was a lovable man.
One of your earliest doubtful jokes, I suppose, too, the Heckler on the Hill in Sydney.
I used to go up when he was scoring for Middlesex. He used to tell me all these stories. And he did say this one in 1924 when he was fielding in front of the hill. And I think it was Tommy Andrews. This was on Arthur Gilligan's tour. And Tommy Andrews skied a ball up to him. And he was hovering underneath it, Patsy, in front of the hill. And the voice shouted out, "Patsy, if you miss that ball, you can sleep with my sister." So I said, "What happened, Patsy?" He said, "Well, as I hadn't seen his sister, I caught the catch." It was a typical sort of end remark.
Poor Pauline, you postponed your wedding simply because there was a test match. Move the date, Brian.
We had to get married a bit earlier. It was a rather good thing, really, because I wanted to make sure of being here for the test match. And the Colonel, her father, wasn't too pleased because I proposed to her after a week and she gave me an answer after a month. And then we decided we had to get married before the cricket season started, so we were married within 3 months. But it seems to have worked. People live together these days and see they'll try it out, but we didn't, and it seems to have worked.
Where are these tattoos years. That she disapproves of so much?
I've only got one just on my left arm here, which is a two-cross cricket bat, which I went to do for when I was doing In Town Tonight. We went down the Shipbuilders Union or something, down in the East End, and this chap with a little electric needle, I was interviewing him, and he's so nervous, and the bats don't look anything like bats, and the little ball doesn't look like a ball, but it's on my left forearm, and I can be recognised by that.
We'd better examine the question, I suppose, of the gaffes. The famous one is the batsman's holding, isn't it? Then you got both of them into trouble with the leg over situation.
Well, this is Agassiz's fault, you see. We were perfectly normal last season, the Friday of the Oval Test match. Bad line to stop play. Producer, who bullies it like mad, said, "Go through the scorecard." So we went through the scorecard and we got to Ian Botham, who hit wicket. And Agassiz made a very long explanation of why he did it and couldn't quite see why he tried to hook that ball. And and he said, in the end, he said he just couldn't get his leg over. And I said, couldn't get it. I got as far as that. And then I was very, I think, more professional then than I've ever been, because I went on reading the scorecard for at least 30 seconds without going. And then I had to, and so I went wheezing away. But what didn't help, Peter Baxter, stupid ass, said to Agassiz, "Say something." Well, Agassiz was hysterical, and all Agassiz could get out was Lawrence, and he went off after saying Lawrence, and he was laughing.
Well, meanwhile, both have been joined by Lewis, and both of them, the end out, most extraordinary way.
Oh, it was ever so sad, really. But it was interesting because we were talking, and he had just started to loosen up. He had started to perhaps look for the big blows through the offside to anything a little bit wide, and I remember saying, you know, it looks as if Ian Botham was just starting to play his old way, and it was a bouncer, and he tried to hook it. I mean, why he tried to hook Ambrose, I'm not sure, because on this sort of pitch exactly, it's a very difficult prospect. It smacked him on the helmet, I think. I'm not quite sure where it did actually hit him.
Shoulder, I think.
Shoulder was in, as he tried to hook, and as he lost his balance, And as he tried to, he knew, this is the tragic thing about it, he knew exactly what was going to happen. He tried to step over the stumps and just flicked a bail with his right
hand. He more or less tried to do the splits over it, and unfortunately the inner part of his thigh must have just removed the bail.
It just didn't quite get his leg over.
Anyhow, he did very well indeed, batting 131 minutes and hit three fours. And then we had Lewis playing extremely well for his 47 not out. Angus, do stop it. And he was joined by De Freitas, who was in for 40 minutes, a useful little partnership there. They put on 35 in 40 minutes, and then he was caught by Dujon Forsh. Lawrence, always entertaining, batted for 35 minutes, hit a four over the wicketkeepers. Angus, for goodness sake, stop it.
Yes, Lawrence played extremely well.
He hit a four over the wicketkeeper's head, and he was out for nine. And Tuffle came, batted for 12 minutes, and then was caught by Haynes on Patterson for two, and there were 54 extras. And Higglemore all out for 419. I've stopped laughing now. Ambrose, 36 overs, 8 maidens, 3 for 80.
And finally, one of the proudest moments of Brown's career was on In Town Tonight, when he wheeled a piano up to the stage door of the Victoria Palace Theatre in London. Bud Flanagan came out, and while Brown played, they both sang Underneath the Arches. No recording of that still exists, but on a view from the boundary during Brown's final test match at the Oval in 1993, he sang it for one last time. With Roy Hudd.
Here is the definitive Underneath the Arches.
Yes, and I want you to know, listeners, that this record is not available in any shops.
One, two, three. Underneath the arches, we dream our dreams away. Underneath the arches, on cobblestones we lay. Every night you'll find us tired out and worn, happy when the daylight comes creeping, heralding the dawn.
Yes.
Sleeping when it's raining, and sleeping when it's fine.
What's above there?
Ba, ba, ba. Trains rattling by, boom, 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 boom. Pavement is a pillow.
Does it matter what's
no matter where we are laid. Underneath the arches, we dream our dreams away.
And that's jazz.